Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the May 1, 2017 meeting of Chelan Public Utility District. This morning's meeting is a study session. This afternoon will be a business session. Four of our five commissioners are here today. Commissioner Bowles is excused, anticipating to return at our next meeting. That last conversation I had with him. That's a really good thing. All the normal regular staff are here today. We have a very full agenda. It's great to see good numbers of the public here for our conversation on various items. And would like to remind everybody from the public that is here, if you wish to speak to any item on the agenda, we have a microphone up here at the table, and we'd ask that you come up and state your name and address for the record if you wish to address any item on the agenda. I also would like to remind people if they could silence their cell phones, that would be most appreciated as that helps with the conduct of business. That being said, we will start this morning's meeting, as we always do, with a Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute led today by Pam Wilson.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Pam Wilson. I am a senior business analyst in the Information Technology Department. I'd like to tell you a true story today, make it really quick. It was a beautiful spring day, early evening, Friday evening. You decide you want to run a couple of errands before the weekend starts. So you take your spouse and your child, and you just run down the hill and run a couple of errands, about an hour and a half. You head home. You turn off of Western, west on 5th Street, and you're stopped by a policeman. Fire trucks everywhere. Policemen everywhere. There's fire and smoke shooting out of Philippines. Fire. And you can't go home. The policeman says, it'll be at least 3 hours before you can go home. Now, when you left your house, you didn't think that was going to happen. You couldn't have planned for that. But today, for the safety minute, I would like to share with you some information from the Federal Emergency Management Agency about preparing for disasters. So I do have some handouts here I would like to pass around, if you wouldn't mind. I hope I have enough for everyone. If I don't, you can go on to www.ready.gov and you can print out these handouts. They're excellent. So this handout tells you there's four things you need to do to prepare for an emergency. Number one, you need to get a kit of emergency supplies that will last at least 3 days. You need to make a plan of what you would do in an emergency. That would be a communication plan with your family. You also need to be aware of the place where you work, their emergency plans, and school plans of your children. You need to be informed about what might happen. You can go on that www.ready.gov site to see if there's any potential threats or concerns. And last but not least, I encourage you to get involved in your community in preparing. On the back of this handout, I would like to point out that there is a list of recommended supplies to include in a basic kit, and this is for everyone. The government recommends that we all are prepared with a basic kit. That includes a gallon of water per person for at least 3 days, non-perishable food for each person for 3 days, a battery-powered radio with extra batteries, flashlight with extra batteries, definitely a first aid kit, and something that I was surprised to read, and that's a whistle that you might use to signal for help. I didn't know that was included. A filter mask or a cotton t-shirt to help filter the air, moist towelettes for sanitation, wrench or pliers to turn off your utilities, a manual can opener if you have canned food in your first aid kit, in your emergency supplies, plastic sheeting and duct tape to shelter in place, garbage bags and plastic ties for personal sanitation, and also include unique family needs, medication if you have babies in the home, those diapers and formula, And also very important documents to keep in that emergency kit. So thank you for your time today.
Wow. That was great. I got to ask you a question, though. Were you able to, was there an alternate route around the site?
I don't know how to put that in. I'll give that to you. No, there
wasn't.
No, there wasn't, but it was a family member, so they came to my house.
Oh, wow. Wow. Thank you.
Thanks, Pam.
Commissioners, item two on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. Before we do that, I would like to, for this afternoon session, propose a slight modification to our agenda, and that would be that the first 15 minutes of our session this afternoon at 1 o'clock that we meet in executive session for the purpose of discussing real estate. Is that appropriate terminology, Eric? Okay, and that would postpone the normal session until 1:15, so it'd be 1 to 1:15. At this time, it's also if there's any items that are on the regular agenda that you wish to have moved to the consent agenda, this would be the appropriate time to do so. And if there's any member of the public that wishes to have any item that is not on the agenda considered, the commissioners would consider that at this time. Any items to be moved?
Can you give me a minute?
You bet.
Commissioners, we did change the order of the resolutions a bit here, too. So if you're thinking about that, I'd just note in particular that item 12 is now the Alcoa agreement.
Okay. I believe there were a couple that were recommended as could be candidates.
Yeah, I apologize. The numbering's different, so now it's not so easy for me. But there were two that we felt like we could put on the consent, and I think one of them would be 15. Is that one of them?
13 and 14.
13 and 14. Search Technologies Corporation, and.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. 14 and 15. My error.
I thought it was 15.
Yes,
yeah. Okay.
You're right.
So I would just recommend that we put resolution 14 and 15 on the consent agenda.
Okay. Any opposition to that? There's no opposition. We'll move them to the consent agenda. All right. Item three, continuation of our Alcoa discussion.
I want to invite Kelly Boyd and Michael Padgett from Alcoa to come up. So the main thing I want to do is we've had 2 weeks of public comment. We've received a fair amount of public comment, and we want to review both what we've done in terms of process and what we've heard and some of our thoughts in response to what we've heard.
Thank you, Steve. For the record, this is Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me at the table is Michael Padgett, Vice President of Energy and Carbon Strategy for Alcoa. For starters, Michael is probably a familiar face to you now. This is his third trip to Wenatchee in 3 weeks. I'd like to thank him for that extra travel effort. And knowing the importance of the ability to have the face-to-face conversations, I think that it's been very important for Alcoa to be here and able to participate in the activities that have happened since the last board meeting also. So thank you, Michael, for your for doing that. So for today, what we are doing is updating on all the things that we have done since the last meeting, where our action item was to have a lot of commissioner and customer outreach and seek feedback from the presentation that was made 2 weeks ago. Since that time, we have had a session with a sub-team of the Alcoa Working Group, which is the group that came out of the Tri-Commission about 18 months ago. And Alcoa joined that discussion on the phone, and there were about 15 attendees there where we dove more into the details of questions and answers around the potential options of as-is or the one-year delay. And then last Tuesday, there was a evening session of the Tri-Commission Alcoa Working Group also, where there was about 50 attendees at that meeting. There were two PUD customers there. There were two Alcoa representatives there. There was a large mix of Alcoa workers and general public there. And then there's also been various service group meetings in the last 2 weeks. And we tallied up about 60 plus on the total of interactions there. And then in addition, we did receive two customer owner emails through our chelanpud.org website. And then we have been tracking some of the comments on social media also as a way to ensure that we're fully informed on feedback from the public. And with all of that, we did prepare a frequently asked questions sheet that everyone has and that was available for handout to the group. And I would like to just touch on those and the themes of those to enter into the record the themes of the questions that we've had over the last 2 weeks. So I will be working off the frequently asked questions handout. And this was also handed out at the April 25th evening session. And on the next slide, I will touch base on a couple additional questions that have come up or themes that have come up since that time. So we are real time trying to get all the comments received through the weekend into this presentation so we can ensure that we share all of the feedback that we got. So on the frequently asked questions, why not just hold Alcoa to the terms of the agreement it signed is a common theme of the questions. I think we had a lot of discussion at the last meeting around that, and that is an option. The pluses of that option is that the payment would be made, but the downside is that Alcoa has advised us that that would likely lead to the decision to permanently close the plant. And I'll let Michael weigh in on that too. So that was an option, but the option that's recommended by staff is a attempt to balance the and preserve the opportunity to restart while keeping customer owners neutral by having a partial payment of a one-year equivalent in June of this year, plus an additional amount to pay for the value of buying that extra year, so maybe terming that as buying time, and then have the remainder of the payment due in 1 year in June of 2018. This is trying to be a neutral impact to customer owners, acknowledging an extra payment to keep everyone neutral and at the same time preserving the opportunity to restart. So weighing all those positives is why staff recommends the option of the one-year delay. The next question is, does the PUD restrict Alcoa to using the power only for their operations? And could they maybe sell that power to somebody else while they're curtailed? And the contract does restrict the use of Alcoa's proportionate share of the output of Rocky Reach and Rock Island to smelting operations only at the Wenatchee Works only. And so that power isn't available for other uses during the contract period. If Alcoa were to close the Wenatchee Works plant permanently, what happens to the contract and that power? So the Alcoa contract would still continue until 2028. The decision to permanently close the plant is not a contract provision that causes the contract to end. So the district would have a decision about the ability to terminate, but that's a separate decision. So the contract just continues on, and the power that would be still Alcoa's power, and the cost to produce that power plus the extra charges are still obligations of Alcoa. So the contract would continue. The power would be sold on Alcoa's behalf in the wholesale market, and then those proceeds would be used to pay Alcoa's share of the cost of production plus their other contract charges. If there's a shortfall, Alcoa makes up that shortfall. If there's a surplus, the PUD retains it. So there's no incentive to remain in that position for Alcoa. That was one of the themes. That was a later theme over the weekend of confusion maybe around what happens to that power, both while curtailed or if there was a permanent decision. And so I did want to clarify that the power is sold on Alcoa's behalf and the proceeds do go to pay for the cost of production. That's currently about $65 million a year. The cost of production goes up and down with different maintenance projects, for example. And right now we have the large projects going on at Rocky Reach especially. So right now the cost of power is in a higher level than it has been in some years in the past. And the wholesale market is in a lower level. So for the most part, those proceeds have not been enough to cover the cost of production plus the plus contract charges. And so the full amounts have went to pay that. There have been a couple months over the 18-month period that have been surplus that the PUD has retained, but it has primarily been shortfall. How was the neutral impact to customer owners decided is another common theme of the question. So to try to ensure that customer owners were neutral to positive, we did look at the other uses of if we would have received the full payment, what could be done with that from the PUD's perspective and what's the value of that. So things like we could use that to pay down debt or to avoid issuing new debt for some of the large capital expenditures or putting it in savings. Those are the types of things that we looked at to determine what the value was. And those were all direct benefits to customer owners. We didn't try to quantify what would be the value of restart to the community, for example, and the additional benefits that that brings. So while we didn't try to quantify those indirect benefits, we did take that into consideration as part of the overall decision-making when it came to making a staff recommendation about the best balance decision to make. Another common question is, what is the original deferred payment for and how can it be used? And at the risk of repeating what we don't want to be said, that this is where the confusion about is this a penalty payment comes into question. So I wanted to be really direct on that to ensure that I could answer any questions around that. But this is a original contract payment that was due at the beginning of the contract. Instead of having Alcoa pay the entire contract charge up front, which is what a like purchaser of a long-term cost-based power contract did, recognizing the value that Alcoa brings to the community through its operations and having those family wage jobs here in the community, Alcoa paid a portion, a smaller portion, at the beginning of the contract, and then we took the remaining balance and we deferred that. And as incentive to have Alcoa have continuous operations during the contract terms, that amount that was deferred is earned over time through operations. So it goes down each year as Alcoa operates the plant. So what the payment is that we're talking about that is coming due in June is, since the plant has been curtailed, which will be up to 18 months in June of this year, then that's no longer being earned through operating the plant, so now it becomes due. So that was one of those unique contract terms to really incent operations and all the benefits that comes with that through the community. So there isn't any restriction of the use of that payment to the PUD. We can use it for anything that's within our statutory authority. And that's where it comes into our goals of reinvesting in our assets and people, paying down debt. Those are the types of items that's available for any use there. And by having those funds available for those uses, that's another way that we can help keep power costs low and benefit everyone with the result of those. So that is the nature of that payment and how it can be used. And then the final question on the frequently asked question handout is, what happens if Alcoa declares bankruptcy? And that has been a concern, both from public and internally with staff. We've worked through that question kind of continuously because it doesn't change necessarily even with this one decision. It's something that for the duration of the contract we are very focused on also. And as much as one can be in a situation like this under bankruptcy rules, there is no guarantee. They're really they're hard to interpret because there's a lot of latitude left to a bankruptcy judge to make decisions. But we feel that we are in the best position that we can be. With the delay or without, it doesn't make a difference in how we believe that we have the contractual terms and the actions through securing the letter of credit as collateral for payment of any contract terms. So even deciding between, is there a benefit to pay, to have Alcoa pay now or defer, under either option, we feel that we are protected the best as one can be under this type of situation. Eric will probably reinforce there's no guarantees, but we've taken that into consideration. So those are the themes we have been hearing throughout the last 2 weeks. And then since Tuesday when these were produced too, there's been additional themes that we wanted to touch on also. And the first one is, would Alcoa be willing to discuss property that is not needed for plant operations for maybe other uses? We did provide Michael with Pat Jones from the Port of Chelan County, his contact information. But and Michael, I'll let you comment on that a little bit more.
Michael Padgett, Alcoa. I guess the first thing I want to just kind of reiterate is that the Wenatchee Works facility is in a curtailed state and it's not in a closed state. And so when it's curtailed, it's basically been put to sleep and ready to be restarted and brought back up. So would we be willing to discuss property? The answer is absolutely. But that really hasn't changed from when the plant was operating to right now when it's curtailed. So if there's excess property, we'd be willing to talk about that and discuss that. We wouldn't go to the next step and do anything with property that might hinder a restart. So, but yeah, absolutely open to discussions on that front.
And then the next question that has been a theme also is, do Alcoa laid off employees lose any benefits due to the potential of a one-year delay? So I think that's been another active question. And my apologies to Kelly Woodard. I intended to also comment at the beginning of the session that Kelly Woodard, the president of the Alcoa trade union here, was also in the audience. He's also been attending all these to be available to answer questions. And so thank you also for joining us, Kelly. My apologies that I didn't introduce you earlier. But I think both Michael and Kelly would like to comment on this question.
remember this time. Kelly Woodard, Wenatchee, president of Wenatchee Lumen Trades Council. So, do Alcoa laid off employees lose any benefits due to the delay? And no, they do not. There's a misconception out there that if it changes from curtailment to shutdown, that there's another severance package. But the employees at the time of the curtailment had the option. There was actually three different options. You could take a retirement. They could take a payment and so much money for each year of service, or they could get the benefits, depending on how long they were there. Less than 10 years, more than two, they got up to a year. 18 months for people that had over 10 years, and less than 20, then 24 months for people that had over 20. So those were the options. There's no new option. The only thing that was different than maybe a layoff or normal curtailment is that for the retirees, there's waiting. We have different retirement packages, Rule 70, Rule 65, Rule 80, and so forth. Well, there's waiting periods. If you're laid off, you have a waiting period. Someone have 2 years, someone have 5 years. Alcoa waived those, so those people that had that time in were able to take their retirement and start getting it right away. So that's really the only thing different from a layoff, and they're not losing out. The people that were less than 10 years, their subpayments run out in January. Everybody else is guaranteed whatever, 18 or 24 months, so that will continue. So they're not losing anything with that.
Kelly, yeah, this was something I've been grappling with all weekend, because I know some of these people are really concerned. They feel like if we do this one-year extension, they believed in the company, they chose not to quit but to be curtailed. They believe in their company. They believe that, you know, in their heart that the company, that Alcoa, will start back up again. And if not, then they will get there. And I don't know if maybe it's not called severance package. But so why are they so concerned? And why am I so concerned that if there's a delay, if there's, you know, if we give another year, that they may lose their severance? And these are people that have stuck by the company.
They won't lose anything. And there is, and I'll be honest with you, there has been like a fire that won't go out. Some people, and I don't know if there was miscommunication. I attended every meeting that we had during the shutdown when their benefits were explained to them by the state, the company, myself. And there is no additional benefit. They're not going to lose anything. If they're one of those fortunate few that are tier two or three, the benefits that they have will remain in place whatever the PUD may decide to do. They won't be losing anything. There's nothing additional. I've done my best. I think probably the company's done their best to put that aside. I have had people approach me and said that the HR manager at that time had said something about this, but I never heard it, and I was at every meeting, so I don't know if it was just maybe bad choice of words, and they took it to mean something that it didn't, but they will not be losing out on any bit.
So none of that changes.
None of that changes.
And then the other thing is that, you know, none of us can control this, but if in fact, and I hope it's not true, but if in fact Alcoa does decide to seek protection through bankruptcy, that's going to be, well, that's a risk, irregardless of whether we extend for a year or not.
It is
for the employees.
It is a risk, and I hate to say it, but we'd probably be in the line with other creditors, and you know, sometimes that doesn't always go to best. But in any situation, whatever the PUD may do, I don't think that really changes anything for us.
I believe you know more about this than anybody, so that's really helpful for me to hear it from you. Thank you.
I mean, don't get me wrong. If there was something out there, I would love to get it for my members.
I'm sure.
I'd love, basically, I mean, the main thing is I'd love to see the plant restart.
Yeah, so would I.
So I was torn about this proposal, you know, from the time that I heard about it. And I knew the meetings. I went to public. I did not really make up my mind which way I was leaning until they had the public meeting. And there were a lot of our members there that voiced, you know, I guess, displeasure. They weren't real happy. They wanted just, but I mean, you never can know what truly is going on in Alcoa's decision making. They don't offer a lot of info to their unions. But looking back at my goal from the start was to get my plant restarted, get my members back to work. And I know a lot of people moved on, but a lot of them are still hoping. Mm-hmm. So I think this gives us the best chance to have that happen. So I have finally came to the fact that I'm for this. If I asked Alcoa, if, you know, they're just kicking the can down the road, just so they don't have to pay it now and then pay it later, it would be more convenient to them not to do that, because I have my members hanging out there, you know, blowing in the wind, just hoping they get their jobs back.
Yeah.
But if this really gives us the best, and I've come to lean that I think it does, then I'm for it.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
I did, after the public meeting, I did approach an HR manager in Pittsburgh and actually went as far as the CEO asking to maybe to keep a quality workforce for a restart, you know, instead of having people moving on, which, you know, a lot of people longer ago would be forced to move on, to maybe extend some benefits. And there was no answer. So I assume that means no interest. And we don't have any leverage, so can't force that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you.
And Michael, did you also want to add some additional information to that?
I think there's really nothing I can put out that Kelly hasn't already said. I was just going to say, you know, it reiterate the same thing. There's no loss of benefits that would come out of this decision. It was a choice, sort of a lump sum, you know, upfront payment or payment out over time, and depending on which one you chose is how it got paid out. So there's no additional issues.
I invited Kelly just to join, so in case there are further questions, that he's easily accessible, and wanted to make sure that it was clear that we've been working with both the company and the union all the way along here to answer questions that have come up along the way.
Thank you. So that does give the full summary of all of the questions, feedback, themes that we've heard, all the activities over the last 2 weeks since the previous board presentation. But in addition to that, Alcoa has also had some activities. So, Michael, could you give us an Alcoa update over the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, when I was here 2 weeks ago, I basically pointed out that we hadn't issued our earnings. That was going to be put out on the 24th. So, you know, we did release earnings a week ago today. And I guess with some of the talks about, you know, the bankruptcy and the issues, you know, I'm happy to report that our first quarter earnings was a net income of $225 million. So we compared that to fourth quarter of last year and first quarter of last year, both of which were losses. So again, moving in the right direction. Out of that $225, a large chunk of that was the gain from the sale of some hydro assets that we owned in North Carolina, roughly half of it. But again, it's a positive turnout and positive cash flow, and a lot more information available on the web. You know, go through that. The other point that I would, you know, take out of the earnings release that I think is positive is, you know, we go through and we look at each of our business unit activities. And for the aluminum section, which is where Wenatchee Works reports into, we're keeping our forecast of the metal balance that aluminum will be in a slight surplus this year. But that compares with, you know, in years past when we had a fairly large surplus around the world. Now it's kind of netted out that there's a bit of a surplus in China and there's a bit of a deficit in the rest of the world. But putting those two together, we're actually pretty happy with where we're forecasting the 2017 balance to come out. And, you know, the last thing that I'll mention, you've probably or perhaps seen it in the news, is that the administration has announced an inquiry into the aluminum industry. We don't have a lot of details on exactly what that means yet, but but obviously something we're very keen to watch as it unfolds and want to make sure that our voice gets heard in there with the industry.
I think it's worth adding a little bit more about that. So the president has the authority to investigate whether there are things going on in the import market that would have an impact on a particular industry. And under the executive order that was issued last week, the Department of Commerce has 270 days, so it would be within the time period of this one-year delay to come to a conclusion as to whether there are things going on in that market, and if so, what actions the government might take in response to it. They look in particular at three things: whether aluminum imports impair the ability of the domestic aluminum industry to meet our national defense needs, whether the aluminum imports have any substantial effect on employment or government revenue, whether aluminum imports weaken our internal economy, recognizing the close relationship between economic welfare and national security. So those are the three things the Department of Commerce will look at and then make recommendations with respect to tariffs, taxes, other alternatives if there's a determination that they are warranted. So that, at least under the terms of the law, would occur by the end of January of 2018.
Thank you, Steve. And then the last item was a action item from the April 25th evening session. Kelly did comment on this a little bit, but there was a takeaway question from that meeting about the discussion with the supplemental unemployment benefits ending, as described, depending on years of service. And would Alcoa be willing to extend the supplemental unemployment benefits to the laid-off workers as part of the discussion of this? So I'll let both Michael and Kelly, if you want to add additional to that also.
Michael Padgett, I think the I know your inquiry was received, and I reached out to Nick Storm and make sure he was looking at it. So I don't think there's an answer been sent back yet, but that's the update I have, is I am following it, and I know we're going to come back with an answer.
So. That they're still looking at it, I guess that's good news, because I kind of took it as a denial. So if they look at it and come back with something, that'd be great. Because I think it's in Alcoa's interest to try to keep, you know, we're highly physical, but there's a lot of technical a smelter, a lot of technical jobs. And if you lose that from people moving on, there is. I mean, I know that in the public meeting you said that we've started up new plants, and I know you have, and I know it can be done. But I think more economical is we can keep those people with those skills, you know, available for restart would be great.
Could I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So I'm a little unclear on this one. I have heard it said that if this were to change, it would be an amendment not to the local contract, but to the international contract. Can you clarify what kind of amendment would be necessary in order to make this happen?
This is part of a master agreement that covers a number of plants across the U.S. So there are restrictions on, you know, what Alcoa can unilaterally do at a specific site. I don't know how you work around those or what you do in terms of, you know, amending the contract. But I do know that it's not a one-off, you know, specific to Wenatchee action.
I just like the, we did the, I mentioned before how we waived the waiting periods in the contract for retirees. That's part of the national agreement on those waiting periods. I think that we could do that as an amendment, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'd have to have our lawyers look at it, but I think we could do that as amendment to the settlement agreement.
So I'm unclear. So what would that waive the waiting period? Tell me, can you explain more about that?
Yeah, the waiting period in the contract says that when you're just laid off, that we have different types of retirement, rules of 70, which all have to do with age plus years of service, rule of 80, rule of 65. Mm-hmm. Well, each one of those has a waiting period. Rule of 65 has 5, the other ones have 2. If you're normally
when you're just laid off, you got to wait the 5 or the 2 years until you can get your retirement in a layoff. In this case, the company waived that, and the individuals that had the time and the age were able to start drawing their retirement right away. So we waived that in the national agreement, in the master contract. So I've discussed it a little bit, but I don't, you know, we haven't come to anything for our lawyers to look at, but I think we could do that in the settlement agreement, that we could change the settlement agreement and amend it.
So would it be a fair statement by me if I summarize this one as saying, so the formal action has been taken and is underway and isn't changed by the decision related to this 1 year delay, since the formal request is already, I don't know the right terms to use, Kelly, but is that the right way to describe that?
I would say that's the correct way to describe that, and I would say that you're right, you're correct.
So with that, that's maybe a good, maybe this is a good place to pause too for any maybe questions that you heard that we didn't answer, or themes maybe that there are still questions on.
I'd like to offer that not only to the commissioners if there's any questions, but any member of the public if there's a question. This might be a good place for questions.
I have a question, but I want to wait till the other commissioners have spoken, because I've already asked my questions before.
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay. Well, a comment and a question. I just want to make it really clear that I, as one commissioner, I would really like to see the plant reopen. I had a friend who stopped by my house yesterday, who I taught him algebra many, many, many years ago, and he was laid off. He is not is he curtailed? Anyway, he stopped by and was looking for work, was wanting work with my husband, and we spoke for a while, and, you know, my heart goes out to these guys, and they're in limbo, which is a really tough place to be. So I want the plant to open as much as anybody else, but I have a fiduciary responsibility to the entire district and to all the customers of the district, not just to the Alcoa employees. And, you know, what keeps nagging at me, Michael, is if it becomes economic for the plant to reopen, for Alcoa to decide to reopen the plant in Wenatchee, I just struggle with, you know, is making this payment to Chelan PUD that's owed money. It's not new penalty money. It's money that is owed the PUD. Is $67 million payment to Chelan PUD really going to affect that? You know, that decision to reopen that plant. This is an international corporation, and, you know, I struggle with that. I think if it becomes economic, it's economic, and they're going to reopen the plant irregardless. But that's just my gut feeling.
I mean, I think, as again, there are a lot of things that go into the decision, and if you're looking at a model that says, you know, it makes sense to go through and restart it, giving all the inputs, we would probably make that decision. But you're just putting an additional, you know, bogey on the front of it with the payment in terms of sort of the restart costs and the cash outflows that you have to overcome. So I think you're right. It just makes it a little bit more difficult to come back to that where the equation solves.
Would it be possible to do it on the other end, for example? So what I'm saying, would it work for Alcoa to for us not to extend for another year? Alcoa make their payment, and then if in fact you do decide that it's economic to open, then we could incentivize that on the other end later. Has that been considered, Kelly?
So I'm not sure if I understood how the incentivize on the other end of that would.
I don't know how that would work either, but is it possible we could get our payment, get our $67 million that's owed, and then if down the road Alcoa decides it's economic to reopen the plant, Could we at that time then provide some incentive?
So I would say that how we considered that in this variety of options is that with the advisement from Alcoa that the payment up front would make it likely that they would not be able to restart because of how much you have to recoup through both startup costs and this payment, that the way to balance that opportunity for restart by paying a partial payment now and then deferring for 1 year for some of these other things that could have a positive benefit, that's the greatest incentive we can provide, because if the plant would be to restart within that delay period, then that payment that would become due, they would join back to the contract and it would be earned again through operations. Right. So there wouldn't be a cash outflow if the plant was to restart, because it would rejoin the contract and be earned through continuous operations, which is the original goal of the contract. And it is consistent with the theme of providing those community benefits. So we felt that the greatest incentive we can give is to incent that restart, and that the one-year delay period does that. So that's how we considered it through these options.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out a way for us to not have to give the greatest incentive that we can possibly give that could harm us and get what's owed us. But yeah, I'm just as usual, thinking out loud, brainstorming out loud.
Well, and that was definitely a criteria where we had shared the principle of a neutral to positive impact to customer owners. So we also didn't recommend any options that we felt would have an adverse impact on our customer owners. By paying a portion of this deferred charge that would represent the one-year piece that from not operating for another year, plus an additional amount, which is the additional $2.8 million, that's an additional amount received by the district to have a neutral impact. So we do feel that the combination of pay a part now plus the extra and defer for incenting restart in the next year does have a neutral impact on customers and not adverse. Yeah. So still trying to balance all of your concerns with the options considered.
I just have a comment. But I'd like to wait until after there were questions from the audience.
Any member of the have any question or comment? I think you're up, Steve.
I as well attended the meeting the other night and basically had the same reaction that you did, Kelly. Things have been weighing very heavy on my mind, particularly as a new commissioner coming in trying to learn the history of how that contract was put in place to begin with, understanding the company's situation and the employees' struggles that they're going through, and the many opinions in the community, governmental versus and public opinion. They're all valid concerns, and in many cases seem to be competing and offsetting one another. So my decision has been heavy. And so the way for me to come to a vote is to do my due diligence and study. I want to make sure that, as Kelly mentioned, we're staying neutral or positive to our customers. And yet at the same hand, I didn't feel really comfortable leaning towards the company, leaning towards the employees, using our position. It's not where we fit in here. If you look at our mission statement, we're here to provide sustainable, reliable utility services to enhance the quality of life in Chelan County. And our job is to make sure that whatever actions we're taking to the best of our ability assure the financial stability and resources of our agency. And I've gone through and looked at the collateral and the securities, and I feel that after reviewing those that an extension of that for 1 year is in the best interest of our organization.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Could I say one more thing?
You bet.
Yeah.
Well, mostly I just want to say that when I hired in Alcoa, we were running 5 lines. We had 1,000 employees. At that time, we were the biggest employer in Chelan County. And a lot of people, a lot of generations have worked at the plant. They've raised their kids, sent their kids off to college without, you know, having to take out a gazillion dollars worth of loans, bought their houses. It's one of the few jobs in the valley. If you don't go get a degree somewhere, and I think it's kind of sad that when you do that, a lot of times there's not that many of those type of jobs. You have to leave the valley. This is one where generations have stayed in the valley. And I just want to say that we appreciate that work that the PUD has done to keep our plant open. And hopefully this continues on, that we get our plant reopened and we can continue this. Without the PUD, we would have been gone a long time ago. When we were running those 5 lines, we got basically roughly 2.5 lines worth of power from the PUD. Then we got the rest from the BPA. And at that time, there was 10,000 aluminum workers in the Northwest. And well, those jobs went away, but ourselves and Intalco are the only ones left. And I'm hoping that we're the last ones left. That's what I'm hoping. And the only way we can do it is if Alcoa and the PUD keep working together. So thank you very much for what you've done over the years for my members, myself, and everybody else.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Very nice comments. Thank you.
Okay, well, hearing no additional questions, I do just want to quickly touch base on the two options for consideration. Were the as-is, make no changes, and have the payment due in June of this year, versus the option for renegotiating contract terms for a 1-year deferral of the contract payment terms in exchange for an additional payment amount from Alcoa. So pay a portion now and defer a portion to be paid in 1 year. We went over the kind of the details of option 2, which is to pay that partial amount plus an extra in June of this year, and then defer the remainder for 1 year. And should the plant reopen, then the existing contract terms apply, and that remaining balance would be earned over the remaining contract period through operations. But should the plant remain curtailed, then that deferred payment would become due in June 2018. And at the same time, during this delay period, the collateral protection would extend through that same period at the current amount to help with that, again, protecting our customer owners and having them remain neutral. So staff does recommend the second option, that we renegotiate the contract for the 1 year period. That would entail a payment this June of $7.3 million, which would include a 1 year portion paid up front, plus an additional amount for buying time, and then have the remaining portion deferred for 1 year. We do believe that this has a neutral impact on the district and our customer owners, that it extends the collateral required to further protect our customers. All the other key contract terms apply, like the power can still only be used for smelting operations at Wenatchee Works, so it's not available for other uses by Alcoa. It gives the best opportunity for restart. It preserves that choice for Alcoa. And with all of those things weighed in, we do feel that it's also the best overall positive benefit for the community, as it reflects the original contract goals of having Alcoa operate in our community and provide those family wage jobs and all the additional community benefits that come with that. So that is our recommendation. Are there additional questions?
Any questions or comments from commissioners or any member any member of the audience? For those that aren't looking at the agenda, on our regular agenda this afternoon, the first resolution is a resolution pertaining to Alcoa. And so we won't be taking any action until at least 1:15 this afternoon, but we need to, since we've published that, if there's any other additional comments, we'll provide that opportunity right at that moment in time. And thank you for good presentation, all three of you. Thank you
very much.
That was very informational for me. I know that.
Kelly, really glad you came. May I be really clear? Let me just make sure I'm clear on this. So, Kelly, based on everything that you've read, everything you know, talking to all your employees, you now support the one-year deferral in terms of that's the best thing. You believe that's the best thing for your employees?
I believe it's the best thing to get my plan open and get my members back to work. So I do support the one-year deferral.
Thank you.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yep.
Along with the rest of us. Thank you. Yep. With the commissioner's permission, we'll, looking at the clock and managing the clock, we'll rearrange the morning a little bit and postpone item four maybe till this afternoon and go move right into underground transmission and substation update. Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Looking for a response.
Sorry. Yes.
We are listening.
I guess I got up before that was actually approved.
Holy cow.
So, Commissioners, there's really two parts here that are connected. First of all, questions have come up about what does it take to underground transmission. And so we got a little help from a consultant to put together some information just about undergrounding versus overheading transmission. I want to make sure we are clear there's a difference between transmission and distribution. So this only applies to transmission. There are similar issues, but not exactly the same with respect to distribution. Mm. So this is some background information, and then we're going to move from there to an update on what's happening with the substation siting issues.
Good morning, Board of Commissioners, Steve, everybody in attendance. My name is Steve Wickel. I'm the Transmission Engineering Manager. I'm here with Chad Bowman, the Director of Transmission and Compliance, and Jim Caldwell is the Transmission Line Engineer in the Transmission Department. So this is a little bit for information on underground transmission versus overhead transmission. Large part based on a white paper provided by HDR Incorporated. They do a lot of transmission line consulting for us and have for almost 10 years, I believe, or over. And again, this is for information only. No action is required. So my pointer's working. Real quick, this report contains conceptual estimates. Chelan PUD does not have experience with underground transmission. Our cost estimates, these are based on the conceptual design of just one consultant. Using their experience from around the nation. Specific construction methods and materials along with other assumptions are stated in the report that was provided to Chelan PUD. These specific methods may not be the methods chosen for a site-specific project. Cost estimates could be significantly different for an individual project. And the last note here on the substation taps, they require double circuit construction so that there's reliability to customers. So as opposed to networked transmission where a line can go out and transmission finds other paths to get the power where it needs to go. When you're directly serving customers, that one line goes out, your power is out to the customers. So this double circuit construction is really to get kind of two paths. One can go out or one can go out for maintenance while the other is actually serving the power. So in a comparison here, underground versus overhead, these costs are based on essentially level terrain in an urban setting. If on hilly or mountainous terrain, costs can increase twofold or even more. Substation taps require a redundant supply. That was the last comment I made on the last slide. The life expectancy of underground is approximately 40 years. These costs that aren't included in this estimate are environmental studies, state local permits, easements, and land acquisition. So in jumping right to the estimate, the double circuit cost per mile, so again, we're kind of looking at a substation tap because that seems to be what we're looking at here, is around $6 million per mile. There's a single transition structure, and I'll show you what one is, in order to get from the overhead transmission to underground, and that is estimated at a little over $200,000 for that transition structure, for a total project cost of 1 mile of underground at around $6.3 million a mile. And looking at the overhead costs, again, this is a kind of a standard installation on level terrain, urban setting. If on hilly or mountainous terrain, these costs can increase also. The life expectancy is 80 plus years for a steel transmission line. Again, the same things are not included in these costs. And so we have an estimate of about $800,000 per mile. And there is a structure inside the substation that could cost as much as $200,000. And so a total project cost for overhead could be around $1 million a mile. So in looking at the difference, underground right-of-way versus overhead right-of-way, you can see up here it shows two trenches for double circuit construction. That's not necessarily a requirement. This also shows two separate circuits in a single trench. So there are different construction methods. This bottom slide shows 40 feet for a right-of-way, so the right-of-way is not too wide. But the big concern at the bottom is you have limited land use within the right-of-way. Trees can't be over the right-of-way. We can't have the roots growing in to the conduits and the cables. Driveways and buildings would need to be planned for carefully, most likely ahead of time in any development, just because of the construction. For overhead, you can see it's generally 100-foot right-of-way, and that's to account for the swing of the lines, etc. But the land is mostly impacted right at the structure locations, right? You can still have trees and buildings in the right-of-way in many circumstances. So this picture, there's a transmission structure there and another one far off in the distance. Sorry, the pictures are so small, but it shows an orchard underneath the transmission line. And again, in the other urban setting, the transmission line is here, and you have trees, and you can have buildings and shops, you know, in the right-of-way, of course, with approval. But it's largely impacted at the transmission structures. And looking at construction methods of underground, conduits and trenches are required for the entire length. And then these cables are put on the inside. I'll pass this out in just a minute. And then there's backfill required. And it's a kind of a cement mixture, but it also has thermal properties to help dissipate the heat because these conductors get incredibly hot. I think I'll pass this around real quick. So this would be typical 115 kV overhead installation right here. And this, be careful with this. It's a little heavy and some of the edges might be sharp. This is the underground cable for double circuit that was quoted in the HDR paper.
How many kV would that be carrying?
115 kV. Both of these are 115.
Both of them are 115.
Just make sure the middle doesn't slide out on you.
So the reason this is so big, just to point out, obviously with overhead transmission, the insulation is the air, is the distance between that conductor to any people or buildings or anything. For underground, it's actually buried. And so that white layer that goes around the outside, that's the insulation protecting the energized conductor from in the center from being in contact with anything on ground.
Just a question. I noticed this appears to be aluminum.
Yes.
And this appears to be copper. Is there a reason for that?
Overhead generally is aluminum. It's got excellent, it's lighter and has excellent conducting properties. Oftentimes for longer overhead lines, there's a steel core inside this. It's called aluminum conductor steel reinforced, ACER. But for shorter installations and inside substations and stuff, just going with aluminum is pretty standard.
And the copper underground is a...
That's the standard.
That's the standard.
Yes.
So this white layer provides the same amount of, adequate amount of insulation as, say, How much? 10 feet or 20 feet or?
Yes.
But you determine it's adequate insulation.
Oh yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is that material? That white material?
Well, oh God, what is the name of it? It's a. I wish I had.
That's all right.
I haven't said the name in so long.
That's all right. You can tell.
XLPE.
Yeah. All right.
I think the last time I presented, I had a name that I couldn't remember too.
I can't remember.
So again, so vaults in underground construction. This is a single vault. So they come in kind of two pieces. You can get them in multiple pieces also. But the these vaults are required at least every 2,500 feet because that's the practical working length of these cables. So every 2,500 feet or less, you need to have a vault to where you can actually splice these cables pieces together. And these vaults are monstrous, you can see, with two entrances, one on each end, and they need to go underground also. And for cable splicing and anchoring on hilly mountainous terrain, you might have to have more vaults. And I'll explain that in just a moment. So on underground, the splices, this is inside an actual vault, a couple of different pictures of splices. Again, relatively short cable runs, 2,500 feet maximum. I've seen that number shorter in other research that I've looked at. There's restraints, so these clamping devices to help keep these cables in place. The normal thermal expansion from power, heavy power and light power, these cables kind of want to snake inside the conduits a little bit. And I make a note here again, on hilly, mountainous terrain, more vaults and elaborate restraint systems are required because those cables just want to creep downhill. They'll start pulling downhill, and so there's additional vaults and anchoring that's required. And so this down here is an example, actually, of them splicing. You can see there's like two chain anchors or pulleys right here pulling these two pieces together. These are big springs. I'm not an expert on this. I did a little research online. And it's kind of a clean room environment once you get to a certain point in the splicing just to make sure there's no impurities that will cause defects in the insulation. Let's see. Lastly, on underground are the transition structures. So this picture here on the left is actually the transition structure. You can see the overhead transmission line going in, and it goes into the cables. Then the actual underground cables goes down inside the pole and then would go to a substation. And so at the substation, it's going to come up from underground and then go into the normal substation equipment and serve the customers. Now, this shows exposed cable. The cable might go up inside the structure, just like it does on the overhead, but just an example. In contrast, I have a couple slides on overhead. So for most of our overhead construction, it's direct buried steel poles. We just dig a hole and set a pole and backfill it. Insulation is done using conventional excavation equipment and line trucks. And so foundations and guys. Sometimes you see these big foundation structures or guy wires. Anytime you have angles where like this line comes in and then needs to go almost 90 degrees, there's going to be tension on that. And so we have guy wires that support those. And in instances where there might not be property available for guy wires, you would have to go with an actual foundation structure so that it's self-supporting. And that increases the cost on overhead versus just going in straight lines like the picture on the right. So, repair considerations. This is very important. We must stock the materials for underground repairs or accept a 4 to 6 month lead time for parts. The repairs require skilled specialists to perform, and Chelan PUD would likely not perform these repairs in-house. This slide here came from the report. For a 115 kV system, they estimate a minimum of 10 days to repair a faulted cable. Now, this also assumes that all spare parts are available, that you can actually find the fault. So that can be a difficult and challenging to even know where the fault occurred, which section of line that actually occurred in, and that you have people trained and available to do the repairs. I highlighted here, if other entities are needed, you need to contract out the actual work. It could go into 20 days or longer. So on the right, on overhead, it's typically hours to repair our faults on overhead line, maybe up to 2 days, depending upon the nature of the fault. But we currently stock the standardized parts for our overhead transmission, and our crews perform this work daily. So in summary, I took a look at kind of two scenarios. The top one is an underground scenario under varied terrain installation, and the bottom is a double circuit overhead. And using the $6.3 million as a starting point and potentially doubling that if it's on hilly or mountainous terrain, you have an installation cost of roughly $6.3 to $12.4 million. In looking at the annual inspections for the next 79 years to get an 80-year life out of this, we estimate that to be around $20,700 a year. And we did a recable at year 40 to get it to an 80-year life cycle so we could compare the two, because overhead had the 80-year life. And this came up with an actual project cost. Oh, I might need a drink of water. Net present value of $7.1 million to possibly $13.3 million or $4 million.
May I interrupt you?
Yes.
Recable, that doesn't mean splicing.
No, that would mean splicing.
That would mean splicing. Yes. Oh, it seems like
so you have to take all the cable out and put new in and put the terminations and resplice
and
in
the
those faults.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So right now we had a quote on the 115 kV cable of about $125 a foot for that big cable that went around. And at, say, $2,500 foot section, what was that? And that's only a half a mile. So that's roughly a third of $1 million.
Okay.
So this might be light on the actual estimate.
Mm-hmm.
So in looking at the overhead, we used $1 million to potentially $2 million. For 1 mile on installation costs, $1,300 a year annual maintenance for 79 years. We don't really have much to do on these. Every now and then, some repair work. And those come out with $1 million to essentially $2 million on net present value. Mm. So, last slide here. Oh, thank you so much. Saved. In looking at advantages and disadvantages of overhead versus underground. You can see at the top the things that favor underground, obviously aesthetics, because you can't see it. atmospheric phenomena, so they're practically immune to weather conditions. Most of the faults that occur on transmission systems are weather-related, lightning, snow, etc. Public safety, obviously the cables are buried, so the risk of electrocution is very low, at least to the general public who's out and around these the equipment. And, of course, human activities, theft, vandalism, et cetera, favors underground. And looking at the overhead, flexibility on the far right there, relatively easy to reroute and reconfigure and upgrade the system with overhead. You can see that underground would be much more difficult with that. Faults can easily be located overhead, typically less than a day or two to repair any faults. And a much more easy to repair. Our district staff is already capable of performing these repairs. And looking at installation costs then, using the numbers from this slide, installation costs are 6.3 to 12.6 more costly. Over the life cycle, around 6.9 to 13 times more costly. And again, at year 40, you have to do a project to replace the cables. So, that ends my informational presentation on overhead and underground. Are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Steve, when I was in Boise, Idaho recently, I just happened to notice their transmission lines, just really looking at those, because they're growing very rapidly down there. Most of their lines are all steel facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I did see the one that came down and went into the pole. I thought, oh, now wait a minute, this is something I've never seen before. But they actually came down and went underground, and then I saw a substation across the street. So that was the first time I'd seen a transmission line come down into that pole. But it was, I didn't, other than that, and I didn't go everywhere, but everywhere I drove, I looked, and their transmission lines have gone all steel.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that a lot of their they have a lot of undergrounding within Boise, right in the downtown area. Did you notice?
I did not. I could see that a lot of their distribution was going underground in all their developments and
right
in all their growth, but I mainly saw transmission lines above. I didn't notice downtown.
To address your comment on steel construction, that is essentially what we do now in transmission department. Is when we do build a new line, it's standard to go in with steel as opposed to wood. But we do have an awful lot of wood, as you know, around the county.
Beginning to recognize a number of members of the audience that are here for substation discussion and transmission, and so I'm encourage you, if you've got questions, right, this is a good time to ask any questions about this part of the conversation. We do, the next segment is obviously on substations, so if there's any questions on the transmission presentation, we'd welcome questions or comments.
Michael Gibb, 610 Boyd Road, Chelan. Hello, friends. Steve, commissioners. I just have a comment, really. First of all, I appreciate the responsiveness of staff and the board members to ask for this comparison. It falls against the backdrop of contemplating bringing transmission down the hill to Area 18. And one of my takeaways from this is that, yes, very expensive, but yes, doable. The other comment quickly I want to make is that I would hope at the next meeting we would see a similar comparison to the cost differential between overhead and underground distribution lines. I know that staff already has some figures in that comparison, but it would be great to get an update on that so that we can avoid the very aesthetically damaging underbuild of express lines under transmission lines as we look at distribution from the additional substation that we locate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Robin Vogel, 63 Balsam Drive in Chelan. A couple questions. It sounds, if I'm understanding here correctly, that we've had essentially one consultant or consulting company that's providing this information. As someone who's done a lot of building and remodeling over the last 30 years, especially with something that is a cost as great as this, including just the overhead lines, I'm curious as to whether or not we actually have a bid, let alone two or three bids from companies that actually do this work. That's my first question. Second question would be, how many ratepayers in Chelan County would possibly be on tap, so to speak, for a possible temporary monthly rate increase to pay for part of this infrastructure? Now, I say Chelan County because no one has convinced me or has even begun to show me that there's not one single penny of my monthly PUD bill that doesn't go for anything that happened in Leavenworth or INIAT or Peshaston or Wenatchee or anywhere else. If someone can show me that my rate that I pay every month only applies to projects in Chelan, then I'd say, okay, then we need to tap Chelan ratepayers if there needs to be additional funds put together for this. And if this cost differential of the $6 million versus approximately $1 million per mile or whatever is anywhere near accurate, then that tells me that we really, and PUD really needs to push for getting a location for a substation that is very, very close to where the need for power is, aka Lookout or Crystal View or Reserve, any of the ones that haven't been built yet. Because my understanding is there's a potential infrastructure for an additional 800 homes for the Butte, and they're going to be next. If we don't solve this now, we're going to go through this whole thing all over again. So those are my comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Should I take the first one?
Sure.
I think the first one was a question. No, we don't have bid because the purpose behind this presentation was to provide a generic, what's generally the cost associated with underground versus versus overhead. And as Steve said early in the presentation, we did not apply this to a specific location. And that's why you see the wide range of costs up there, because there's a variety of different applications in terms of what the cost would be. It was really for informational purposes for the board and for the public to understand just what's at stake here on undergrounding. And we get the question quite frequently, why? Why would it cost so much more to go underground? So the purpose here was to kind of look at, so what are the things that go into an undergrounding decision versus an overhead?
Bishop, you bet.
Like that gentleman, Kelly, I'm going to try and do this right. Carolyn Glossinger, 490 Boyd Road. My question is, when you talk about repairs, okay, what is the difference? Because we've just undergone a whole bunch of repairs for the fires that constantly, yearly, happen out here. And more than likely will not affect if we're underground. So what are we saving by having underground cable? I understand it's expensive to get it underground, but what are we saving yearly in cost by having underground? And it's not just fires, wind, because trees are falling, etc. Those type of repairs are yearly. And that's yearly for above ground. So what's the difference there? I'd like to understand. You say favorable for underground, but if we're going to start getting down to costs, I really want to understand that cost. Thank you.
So in looking at fires are probably the biggest thing that take our transmission lines out for any extended period of time and take out a section of that. Most of the faults that occur on the transmission system are weather-related and very transient in nature. We have what's called automatic reclosing on transmission, so that a fault occurs, lightning might strike the line, and within three or four cycles, now there's one cycle is 16 milliseconds, so in a very short period of time, that fault is cleared, and 1 second later, or maybe less, the line recloses, the fault is cleared, and all business goes on to normal. So fires are something, though, that's permanent and requires an outage, and we go in and replace those. Trees in the line can be temporary or permanent. That mostly impacts the line that goes up over the summit. I don't have costs associated with this offhand right now for what the fires cost, and that can be something we can certainly try to look at.
So I'd just like to point out, it's true that the cost of repair is not in this analysis. The reason for that is that it's very difficult to determine the probability of the event. So what you have is the possibility of a higher probability event with an overhead because it's subject to weather, but you have to multiply that times the consequence of the event. And it's a much more expensive repair if there's a problem with a fault, which is part of Steve's presentation, if you're trying to repair an underground line. So it's the combination of those two that would determine the outcome. And our sense is that when you take a look at multiplying those two probabilities, that you will not see much of a difference between the two options. In other words, it doesn't influence very much. So you have to take into account it will be much more expensive to do a repair on an underground line if you have a fault occur, just harder to get to. So that's for that reason, we didn't feel comfortable trying to analyze it and throw it into this conclusion because we didn't see it as likely to significantly change the conclusion.
Additional questions or input? You bet.
Wendy Eisenhart, I'm Mayor Pro Tem of Chelan. I've been involved with the PUD on the Electrification Committee, and this came up, and also with the new substation siting. I just want to say that I greatly appreciate the PUD's attitude and willingness to look into this. That has come across loud and clear in all of the sessions. And I also want to say that I want to do this. I want the underground. I think for scenic communities like Chelan, there's no question we have to get our lines underground. So it's more, how are we going to go about it? And I love the factual information. We have to have that. We have to know what it's going to cost. But then we have to know how to move forward. Within the city of Chelan, we've been trying to find a vehicle to make that extra payment at so that periodically, as our lines are up for renewal, which I guess is every 80 years, it's got to be more often than that, it seems like, that instead of overhead, they'd go underground. So slowly by slowly, over a 25, perhaps 30-year period, the city of Chelan's power lines would become underground. This has been a dream of mine, and I'm still behind it. I'm not giving up on this. And I have so appreciated, over time, being able to talk to Andy and the other technical people that come and work with us. So I would like to enter into some kind of discussions with the PUD, with our city, as to how we can pay for the extra cost. I agree that, and it seems like you're telling us as well, that if the lines go underground, we do not have to be, that we don't have to have transmission lines that are as long as if they're overhead. Our first thing, and you're going to go into this, was to try to get those new substations as far away from everybody as possible so nobody had to look at them. But then coupled with that is then the transmission lines are longer, and we all look at those. And then everyone else hops on. So the cable companies, fiber, everyone jumps on those transmission lines. They will go underground if your lines are underground. They'll go underground. So you are the leaders of this, and I'm so pleased that you are listening to us and what we want to do. And I believe with all the minds and talent working on this, we're going to find a way. So thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
If I may address a comment on the cost real quick, I believe the $2.5 million Chad Rissman's back there, that may have been for the entire combined transmission and distribution. I believe the transmission costs were in the neighborhood of $600,000, but we can look at that.
Additional questions, or you bet.
Don Summers, 319 High Point Lane. My wife and I are building a home in Chelan Hills, and where you live, we'll be living just directly above, or pardon me, below those folks that are friends and neighbors that would be directly impacted by a substation or any additional lines added. We plan to enjoy a beautiful view of Lake Chelan, as they're enjoying right now, and just trying to relate to how we would feel if we had lines or a substation directly affecting us, we'd be devastated. And I guess my one point that maybe individually the board might think about, if you had property that was going to be directly affected by additional lines, how you might feel about that. Appreciate your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. We need to pick it up for the recording.
Okay. Carolyn Glassinger again, 490 Boyd Road. Fault. When you're talking a fault, what are you meaning? Like an earthquake, or what is that?
Yeah, so that's the generic name given to a problem that occurs on a transmission line or even a distribution line. It might be that somebody runs into a pole and knocks the pole or the wires down to the ground, and the fault is really when a short circuit event, when that conductor touches ground essentially and trips offline. Okay. So it could be lightning, weather related, a car hitting a pole, fire, smoke from under the fire. Might not be flames that get it, but just the conductivity of the air changes and the line faults to ground. And so it's any time that transmission line or distribution line goes to ground and trips offline,
through protective devices.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that clarity. What is a fault that is common if you go underground?
That's a really good question, and I am not prepared to answer that. So often, so the insulation, it's really the breakdown of the insulation, that white layer. Advancements in that technology that it lasts longer than it did years ago.
Right.
But any impurities in there eventually break down. That plastic breaks down. Any plastic that you have anywhere in your home, in your underground sprinklers, it breaks down. It doesn't last as long as a metal.
Okay.
And so it's just the natural breakdown of that, the actual heat, the expansion and all the heat that's
evolution
from the power, et cetera. I mean, it's going to break that down, and any impurities eventually break down over time, and you will fault through that insulation and go to ground, and the line will trip out and need to be repaired.
So here's a question, I'm assuming. Well, here's the question. So then when it breaks down, what is a typical period of time before that breakdown happens? Is that 40 years, or does that happen more frequently?
A lot of that can really depend. In typical installations, a lot of times a problem from a manufacturing defect is generally identified fairly early on because it was a problem that was physically wrong. If you make it past that sort of break-in period, you generally go a longer time unless some natural phenomenon occurs, an earthquake that might shift that and break something. And then towards the end of life, so towards that 35, 40, 45 mm-hmm. years, that insulation might be breaking down by then if you don't get it replaced.
Okay. And I also wanted to thank all of you as well for spending the time on doing this. I really appreciate it. And we love Wendy, our group. I mean, we are going to fight alongside her, our community of people. I know you keep seeing the same group of us, but there are a lot of people behind us, you know, very grateful that we can make these meetings because they can't, because they're working or other commitments. But we are working together to work with you guys and our city. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn.
And by the way, it feels that way too. We appreciate the interaction that we're having.
Carolyn, I can give you an example. Manson Elementary School was rebuilt, 20 years ago? I was the principal of the school, and we went underground up into the building. About a month into the school operating, there was a fault somewhere in the line, and it took 3 days for us to, the school had no electricity. Because that electrical wire runs in a conduit, they have special equipment to find out where the fault is, but the conduit picks that noise up all through the conduit, so they were having a hard time finding it. Since that repair was made, I think 20 years ago, they haven't had any problems, but that's a distribution issue, not a transmission issue.
You bet.
Corky Thorson, and I live at 63 Balsam Drive with Robin. And what I want to express is, you know, we had some good information from this gentleman here. You know, costs are significant. I acknowledge that for undergrounding transmission. I appreciate Wendy's comment. Anytime you do something that's out of the norm, that is going to benefit an area, there's going to be significant cost incurred probably because of the originality of it. So I'm still advocating for undergrounding, but what I really would like to say is that in the year 2017, I'm just appalled that the way to solve this transmission and distribution problem with the new substation is to put 30-foot higher poles in front of our beautiful view to serve Lookout, to serve Crystal View and other developments who have undergrounding in their existing infrastructure. So I don't know what it's going to take, but let's put our heads together and figure out a way to have shorter transmission lines. Maybe locate, and this is going to come up with a substation, I know, in the next few minutes. Locate the substation near the lookout, near Crystal View, near the people who need it, so that we aren't the ones that are penalized by this. Because if you saw what we have up there as far as a view, which we paid for and expect to see for as long as we had it, you would be appalled to think that there are going to be six more lines and 30-foot higher poles up there. So appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Corky.
Thank you. Okay.
Good morning. My name is John Dreyer, and I live at 126 Pinnacle Place in Lake Chelan County. And I was going to, you see a lot of us all the time, and so I was going to shave off my mustache, so, you know, I would look like a different person, but no. I've only done that once. I shaved it off. My wife and I has never seen me without it. So we went on a vacation, and when she was outside by the pool, I shaved it off. And needless to say, it's back on because she couldn't take it. So, okay. I think I'm going to dovetail a lot of what others have said. I'll make it very brief. First and foremost, thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. And thanks to the team of people that we work with. I've been on that subcommittee now. We're closing in on 2 years. And they've always been responsive. I wrote Tika last night at midnight. I got a first thing this morning. I got a response back. And it's... you know, it's a phenomenal team, and we really respect them and appreciate their effort. But what I've, and one of the things about being on this team is now wherever I go, I'm looking at substations, I'm looking at power poles. It's almost an obsession that I live in Renton. We sold our home there. We live here, and there, a lot of stuff's on the ground in Seattle area and things like that. And there are not a lot of views. I mean, I had a nice view of my neighbor, but and there are some high wires, but there are certain areas that they've designated where they're at. So there is a need for that. But where we're at in Lake Chelan, and I think the folks have said here, is it's a place that people come for a specific reason. The lake, the view of the mountains, the view of the lake itself, and you know, we have to, as a community, do a better job of when we build new construction, what the infrastructure is going to look like, and how can we do that before things get built, and then, unfortunately, folks like you are put in a position of saying, oh, we have to come up with a way of supplying power, and the only way to do it in traditional sense has been overhead and the substation itself. And so we've had lots of discussion about how do you disguise a substation, not just necessarily building a building around it, but, you know, landscaping, trees. I was going to talk to the team about in the next meeting taking a lesson out of Hollywood and putting, you know, like a storefront. We have one in Fairwood, Renton, where it's right in the parking lot of the shopping mall. You can't, nobody ever notices it. But there are no lines going to it. Everything's underground. So I think it's right that, you know, when somebody says that, you know, you see the same faces. I'm on the board of trustees for Chelan Hills. And so I talked to a lot of people, and we had a neighborhood meeting talking about where and how this should work. And the consensus is that, you know, it might be a mile from one place to another, as Mr. Gibbs has made a proposal. That's 1 mile. We would be willing to pay for that. I mean, in some form or fashion. We're willing to work with all of you to make this work. Because in the long run, we're going to see a lot more. We're probably going to need 2 more substations when this is all said and done. But I think it's important that we kind of set the pattern of how we're going to operate for the future, especially in areas like Chelan County or Lake Chelan or a place like that. So, again, thank you very much, and thank you all for your support for us, and we're going to be working really hard with the community to make sure that we get the best bang for our buck. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
All right. Any other input on the transmission? Thank you. Good information. Thank you. Substation.
Well, we have a really fairly significant presentation to make here in 15 minutes. So I'm going to suggest we go ahead and start, but we may be running into the lunch hour here.
Okay.
So where this is going to go. So Chad Rissman's going to join us.
John, while these guys are coming up, in Boise, Idaho, I'm driving by. Is that the gentleman from Chelan? Is his name John?
Yeah.
Yes. I pulled over to look at a transmission line, and my wife says, "Are you kidding me?" So, I get it.
About overriding your presentation this morning. Yes.
So while this presentation is coming up, I want to point out what we're going to try to accomplish here today. We continue to be a staff. We continue to be very concerned about the load growth in the Chelan area. That the process, which we feel very proud of in terms of the way it's worked and the communication, it is taking time, and it's nudging us up against that period when we think we have significant risk of being able to meet the load in the Chelan area. So we have a tension here between trying to get the process right, lots of communication, good engagement, good understanding of the decision, and a need to move to try to make sure that we are able to provide reliable service. At the meeting a month ago, we narrowed the list of options. We looked at options that were away from the load center and concluded that they had too big of an impact relative to the particularly viewshed impacts, which had not been as big a part of our consideration up until then, and the number of easements that would be impacted. Today, we're going to suggest narrowing the options some more in terms of trying to get us down to a place where got a better chance of succeeding and actually getting moving on building what's needed to be built here. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad and to Gary.
Thank you, Steve. Chad Rissman, Director of Asset Management and Distribution and Engineering.
Gary Rice, Project Manager and Engineering Project Management.
So just going off a little bit of Steve's introduction there, thinking back to the beginning of this process, we knew and understood that this was going to be a journey, and that the process would help define itself as we started going down the path of selection. So this is yet another iteration in that journey and trying to bring decision points, bring transparency to some of these decision points. We can understand the directions where we want to go. You know, the cost of that is time. So want to thank everybody for everybody's patience and participation in the process. We're bringing more information back to the group so that we can understand the direction that we want to go. So what I'm going to attempt to do here today is to walk us through presenting information so that we can help set up the decision point, as what Steve said, is narrowing in on how we're going to select the site. Excuse me, I woke up with a little cold this morning, so a little bit hacky. Remember at the very beginning of this, we set up a evaluation criteria. That evaluation criteria, if I can sum it up in a few different parts, included operations. We need to be able to access it and needed to be able to work. The goal here, the ultimate goal here, is to be able to site a substation to maintain electric service in that North Shore Chelan area, and also to provide some benefit for growth. So we set up the selection criteria, and the selection criteria took into consideration the aesthetics, the operations, and the costs. So we keep iterating around some of those various options, and as we're doing that, we're developing more information to help us make decisions. So I wanted to kind of go back just a little bit and talk through what had been done that Steve mentioned, and get us to the point where we are today so we can have some clear direction. So today's agenda in this presentation is review recent decisions, progress update on Chelan substation work since the March 20th board update Steve mentioned, and then setting up that decision point to narrow the load center. And this is going to tie into the transmission presentation that you heard earlier. And then review next steps and timeline. So this is staff bringing this information together so we can receive some comments and look for some direction. I'm going to do this in two different parts. I'm going to do it with the words, so walking through the review and what brings us to where we are today and some of our decision points. And then I'm going to attempt to do it on the maps that we've presented, along with some of the process. So I'm going to try to do this in two different ways in an attempt to create some clarity and transparency. So going back to the March 6th board meeting, presented information on three sites that were under consideration, the UIRC site, Chelan Heights, and Washington Federal. These were sites that were narrowed in on through the selection criteria process in coordination with the board, with the community meeting, community members, and with also with the focus group. We identified these three different sites, and then we performed an analysis, cursory analyses of these three different sites to take and look at what the cost would be, what the aesthetics impacts would be, and then we brought forward another element, and that was easements, so the amount of property impacts. So we brought those three options to the various groups, and the cost and the visual impacts of outside the load area center, what we learned from those that study was that the easement impact, the cost, and the number of aesthetic impacts as a result of those options and having to build additional lines back into where the substation capacity was needed was going to be a significant impact. So that was a lesson learned there, outside of where we wanted to be with improvements. Now we can start to work around various options of those and talking about undergrounding and things, but and those aren't off the table, but what we came to the realization was that the impacts of aesthetics, easements, and costs were going to be pretty far out for those three options. So we presented that same information to the focus group meeting. Thank you, Eric. Provided an update and heard to seek sites closer to the load center. So here's this decision point that is occurring right around this moment where we brought these three options, and these three options had a high impact in a number of the areas that we identified that were important. We looked at some theoretical sites within closer into the load center so that we could get an understanding of what maybe that delta was. We presented those theoretical sites to the focus group, and we received feedback and says, yes, it does look like what we could do better on the aesthetic impacts, the cost impacts, and the amount of easements that we impact by focusing in on the load center and looking at sites closer to that load center. We brought that information then forward to the board on the 20th and presented that information. We got concurrence that we would seek sites in an area that was closer to the load center, bringing forward the information that we think we could improve on all of those selection criteria, decision criteria, including the easements, the costs, and the aesthetic impacts, given the overhead lines. The other direction that we received at that point then was staff directed to analyze the underground transmission option. And thank you, Steve, very much and Transmission Group for putting that together, because that helps inform our decision-making process here. I hear some questions about wanting to understand what the finite numbers are for some of these specific things, given site-specific and site designs and bids and things. So those would be steps that we would take later on in the process where we'd understand what some of the specifics costs were. But as Steve mentioned, what we're trying to understand here is bringing forward as much information as we can so that we can try to narrow and guide us into the best decision. So as I said, I'm going to try to walk through that decision-making process again using this map. When I run the mouse and not do the mouse too fast, can everybody see that up on the screen?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not turning back around. Eric might fall asleep if you turn the light.
I was sick all weekend. That's the only reason I had sympathy for your water.
Is that good? Can everybody see the mouse?
Yep.
If I don't move too fast. Okay, like I said, I wanted to step through this same process and decision-making process. So just to orient ourselves a little bit here, so this is a North Shore area. The yellow is the transmission lines. The red circles are the areas that we identified early on in the process that are areas of interest that we would like to explore further. The three sites in the blue were the URIC site up here, the Chelan Heights site here, and then down closer to the golf course was this Washington Federal site. All options that we explored, and as I previously mentioned, we brought, we performed some additional analyses, and this table down here, again, very busy slide, so just trying to get this information out here, so help with the decision-making process. Here's a summary of the impacts for these three different sites. And you can see how we decided to measure the visual impacts, the Chelan Heights visual impacts. And these are meant to identify the number of potential homes or folks that would be impacted. So Chelan Heights was 110. And then Washington Federal was the largest at 185. So the idea there was, How many visuals would be impacted, visions to the lake from homes, given these various options, and these are largely due to the new lines that would be built. So, again, going back to one of the other analyses that we did was the number of easements that would be required for each one of these, and we understand this just to mean that they understand what the property rights would be required, and it speaks to the constructability of some of these options and the number of private properties and things that would have to be acquired, and so just adds a challenge there. And then the cost, of course, is $9 to $12 million. At the beginning of the process, one of the bogeys that we've got laid out there, somewhere around $3.5 million or so, were the last few substations that we've built, and there's some differences here, and there are some differences here, but we're understanding that each one of those numbers were high. So what we understood then from the Board 20th presentation is that we would focus our efforts then into this, what we're calling this load center area. We would narrow our search in here in hopes to reduce some of these decision criteria. Anything to add on this slide, Gary, before I go to the next one?
No.
So I mentioned before that we did some theoretical analyses and made some assumptions about the number of impacts that would be associated with a couple of three areas within that narrowed load center area. And the box down here in the lower left is the result of that analysis. So the Boyd Site Road, which is here, and there's not a specific site associated with that. We just assumed it would be similar to other ones, but we would reduce the amount of lines, overhead lines, or lines that would be required in order to serve to the load. The next theoretical one that we put together was site number 7. That was one of the original circles and had higher marks on our evaluation criteria. And then the other one that we've heard comments on to focus more energy on was the Site 18, which is often commonly referred to as the High Point site. Lookout site. Again, I guess I want to come down to the analyses, the results of these analyses, the visual impacts. The visual impacts for the Boyd Road site was 30, 20 for site number 7, but then site number 18 was 220. That 220 number really stuck out to us. That 220 was the number of site impacts we felt that would be impacted by primarily the transmission line, a new transmission line that would have to be built from the transmission line here in the yellow that would be built across the highway down through the neighborhoods and into the substation, which is what triggered the further study for undergrounding. So as a result of that undergrounding study, we're understanding there's another decision here to be made. So just to recap a little bit, these theoretical sites, the three theoretical sites, the Boyd Road site, site number 7, site 18, we achieved several things with looking at the load center. We proved essentially that, hey, we can reduce the visual impacts, the easement impacts, and the costs that are parts of the decision-making criteria by reducing the area that we're looking into for a particular site. We look to those analyses to help support that decision in narrowing in the load center. Just a time check, Steve, here.
I think you're going to need to keep going.
Okay. So, based on the information that was provided by the transmission group, we looked at that impact for site 18 and the 220 visuals, and naturally we go to, well, let's underground. So we understand now what that underground option means and what that might mean to the costs. So moving on to this next slide, there's a decision point to be made. There's a decision here. This is a this slide shows where we would narrow the search, eliminating the overhead transmission line to go anywhere below the transmission line here. This option assumes then that undergrounding is cost prohibitive. Undergrounding of the transmission line is cost prohibitive. So options that would be below the transmission line then would be eliminated essentially by having this further refined underground transmission line adjustment made. So that's a decision point.
Chad, I want to add one thing. So it's not just a cost consideration, as I understand it. The moving from the substation and trying to go underground with the transmission down to that site 18 would also require the development of easements that would incur the problems that Steve Wickel described relative to, so that would have to be an easement that where you actually have to dig a trench the entire distance, probably across a lot of people's property, and then you would have to maintain that in a fashion in which you wouldn't be able to really use the property in the way people have become accustomed to. For me, at least, that it was the combination of those two that made me think that that is unlikely to be successful.
So, in summary, here's where we end up with the information that has been generated so far. Again, the three outlining area sites had significant cost, visual impacts, and easements. We started to understand that we could improve on all three of those, so we began to pursue sites or look into areas within a narrowed load center area. With theoretical examples, we showed that we can improve on all three of those, with the exception of a transmission line coming down across the highway and through the neighborhoods, which led to the undergrounding of transmission study. Looking at the underground transmission study, that's cost prohibitive. So having a reduced focus in a reduced load center focus is the direction that we're currently looking at moving into. So we eliminated options south of the transmission line, including site number 18, the lookout. So we want to move forward with looking into further specific sites associated with that narrowed load center.
Yeah, I'd like to add another point here too, which is that choosing the to narrow these options to the ones north of the transmission line does not seek to make a decision as to whether any transmission or distribution in that area would need to be above ground or below ground. It is relatively clear, though, that the amount of transmission and distribution that would be necessary for above the for north of the transmission line would be less than south of the transmission line. And we certainly have heard from the community a willingness to consider an LUD or some other way of paying for this. The likelihood of being successful at something like that looks to us to be higher because the costs would be lower. There's going to be less infrastructure that and less cost that would be necessary to underground at the at sites north of the transmission line. So it creates a better viability of, if for those who are interested in pursuing underground, better viability of success of that. So again, not trying to make that decision one way or another, and wouldn't really be able to until we had good cost estimates, but this looks like at least creates more options for being able to go down the underground path.
Is the impact of the easement under, so we know from the report that the impact and non-use underground is significant for transmission. Is it the same for distribution lines that go underground? I mean, it seems to me that distribution lines are all over the place in developments and people still mow over them and...
Right, so the difference in distribution and transmission is just how well we protect the two facilities given the consequence of their impact. A distribution line through a neighborhood could take out 10, 20, 30, 50 homes and customers, whereas a transmission line, you're talking about multiple substations that are, so you could be talking 10,000 customers. As a result of that risk, there's a lot more effort that goes into protecting those lines. One of the more common faults or failures that occur on the distribution system are dig-ins. We cannot have that for a transmission line. We would need to eliminate that, which is a part of protecting that right-of-way in that area. We just could not afford to have a dig-in occur on the transmission line. Not just for safety, but for operational issues.
Thank you.
So here's a plan, next steps, and timeline that we came up with here, and looking for comments. So here we are today, May 1st, updating the commissioners. What we would think, we would take a further look into the narrowed load center area, and we would start surveying potential properties and coming up with that analysis that we had performed on the previous three that looks at aesthetics, costs, and easements, and understand for specific sites what we might be able to achieve in comparison to the previous three sites and making sure that we can be consistent with our decision-making criteria. We would then, as we did before, take that information that we generated, the specific sites, along with an analysis of those different areas, like we did before, and bring them to the focus group and understand pros, cons, direction, acquire some information about what those various options that we come up with look like. That to occur sometime around towards the end of May. And I'll just say Gary is going to be leading the effort to put all this stuff together. So thank you, Gary, for the timeline. March 30th, then June 1st, as we did before, was to bring the information, not only what was generated by Gary and his team, but also an understanding of the comments that we received back from the focus group and bring that all to the community meeting. Again, acquire additional information and understanding of what those various options look like. Then we might start working towards finalizing our conceptual cost estimates and our line routes. And then we would go into a feasibility study, which is essentially just narrowing in on the options and understanding, as we heard comments from a group, that a better understanding of what the cost would actually be, including bids and specific site designs, so that we can make sure that we are staying within the bounds that we had created. July, somewhere around that would be completed somewhere around the end of June, and then in July, update commissioners and look for possible requests for approval on preferred alternative, and then hopefully we would start finalizing design and purchasing equipment towards the end of the year. So I know there's a lot of moving parts in this timeline and layout, but just wanted to give a perspective of what things might look like if we continue to move forward down this path, given what was presented today.
Any questions, commissioners?
Great job, Chad.
Thank you. Any questions from the public? I know we're past the normal lunch hour, but we'll, you bet.
Put a question there.
Carl Bossinger, 490 Boyd Road, Carolyn. Chad, this second guy right here, what I'm not understanding is, help me understand the green dots a little bit more, and there's a couple things that worry us. One is the word substation, and the other is nine lines, and I'm not understanding this guy right here, for example. What, once that... If it happens there, what gets built there and what hangs from there?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, I sat back here and I'm not understanding a lot of this, not because you didn't use the English language right, but it seems like a little bit of a sleight of hand. I'm feeling like it's not so close to the blue line like we had the impression it was going to be when we met last time. And that area is still hanging around Boyd Road and up above the areas that have the greatest amount of impact still feels to me, and maybe us, like there's still a lot of activity there and things that can be seen that we thought as a guiding principle y'all were going to move away from, and we had asked you to do so.
Yeah, can you explain that? Absolutely, and I appreciate the clarifying question, because that's exactly where we are too as staff. So, as I said, what we did is just took a look at the work that we did previously, and we said if we were to reduce the amount of lines, could we reduce the impacts by narrowing in our focus into the orange line? We used those green circles as just an example. All we did was to perform those theoretical estimates to help support us in moving in and looking in the circle.
In your vision, what's in that green circle?
Nothing yet. That's what we want to develop right now.
We all would accept that.
Yeah.
A green line with nothing in it. A green circle with nothing in it.
So that's what you've identified there as the next step, and what I'm proposing, what we're looking at doing next, would be to identify what those specific sites are and perform the same analyses that we did before on the previous three sites, so we would understand what that line routing looks like, what is overhead, how many wires would be there, what are the costs, what are the easements. So not necessarily in those green circles. Those green circles were meant just to represent an example, but we're going to look within what we're brought to the group here today is, we're going to look further within that orange circle, perform some analyses on specific sites, then bring that out to the community group so we can understand exactly what you're asking.
We need to know, I mean, beyond the theoretical, the concrete, what you're planning to do before we can react. But I'm going to tell you, where if this all of a sudden is a variation on a theme we thought was dead, gone, deceased, buried, no longer with us, then that's not going to sit well. I'm just going to, you know, put that out there. I think that's accurate, right? And that scares me. And it scares us. Again, we need to move from theoretical to pragmatic, practical, what you're actually talking about here, for us to really understand how to react. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's worrisome all of a sudden to me. I've been saying to my wife this whole time, to Carolyn, that there's no way that you're going to go back and revisit anything regarding those other three sites or line, you know, the vision intrusion, those kinds of things. And now I feel like, because you put it in words, you put it in writing, and now I feel like it could turn into something yet again that we thought we had, in partnership, abandoned, walked away from. So I'm worried. I'll tell you that. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Gibb, 610 Boyd Road. If in fact our journey leads us for the substation site north of the transmission line, the lower transmission line, and we are looking perhaps at areas 7, 11, 8 on this map,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a compromise that could be made that I would suggest. And if in fact a substation ends up in that area somewhere, then as a team working together, and I'm on the focus group team, let's be very generous in our undergrounding of the new, not only the new distribution lines, but existing distribution lines right now. So if we impact people's neighborhood visual field with a substation, let's balance that with replacing some of the existing distribution lines that are above ground with replacement underground distribution lines. You understand what I'm saying?
Appreciate the comment. Yeah.
So that's a compromise. Yes, there would be a new substation in somebody's field of vision. We already know from Gary's previous presentations that there would be berming and trees and vegetation and all sorts of mitigation to help hide it. But I think part of the community might be able to assimilate that if we see PUD removing some of the distribution lines from their field of vision. And that would be my suggestion. Secondly, very quickly, didn't I read somewhere that in the last few weeks, there have been a couple of property owners that have expressed some interest? Are we to that point?
We've started outreaching, but where we're at now is if we decide to move forward in this direction, we're going to start going down that path.
Okay. So, thanks, Chad. Thanks, mm-hmm. Gary.
Hi, John Dreyer, 126 Pinnacle Place. Some time ago, Mr. Gibbs sent in a proposal that had 18, and I noticed on your chart you said there was a visual impact of 200 homes. Well, I'm not quite sure that's correct, because the site that he's had is about 30 to 40 feet below 150. There is virtually, a large area where you put trees up. The folks that set up above, they're up so high, they don't see that area at all. And then as far as easements and way to get there, Chelan Hills Association has a lot of property there. And we've looked at running underground for a mile or less, up one of the gullies that we have, up to the power that transmission line. And so you'd have a substation that really would be disguised. You wouldn't see it. There are no homes directly there at all. They're way up above. And there's a way to get through the gullies up to the poles without, really impacting neighborhoods and easements and things like that. It would require talking to the association. That's their property. But I think that's doable. So I'm not necessarily sure that just saying that the 18 or somewhere in that area is not on the table when you look at the real specific area itself. I think Mr. Gibbs did a great job of looking at that, and there are ways to get there to address both the lookout, both Crystal View, and Futures. So when we have our meeting, we ought to be able to discuss that a little more in depth. I think that would be...
Would it be safe to say your comments are that we do not narrow up this load center area as what's being presented here, but that we would keep these sites below the transmission line still on the table for further analyses?
I know the last time I wanted to invite you up to kind of walk through it, and because a lot of us homeowners have gotten into the car, driven around, and said, what if? You know, what if it was here? What would happen? Who would have a problem with that? And I actually went up on the hill and started talking to all the neighbors about, what if there was a substation down over there where there is a storage place that has all these big lights that are shining, and they're there day and night, and got their response back. But also, it's really looking at the details of how do you get from point A to point B, and I think there's a way to do it. And surprisingly enough, there are a lot of gullies, and I live next to a gully. I mean, it's pretty far down. So there's a way of maybe getting some of that addressed there. You know, I think we talked about it before. You're going to have to come from the top and then drop down and then go underground a little bit, and then off you go. So
just a couple of things to clarify there. The visual impacts that are represented here at 220,
mm-hmm.
those are primarily related to the transmission line.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons for the lower cost is that, as a whole, lines themselves, overhead or underground, are dramatically reduced because the station is pretty close to the load center, that blue line. The other thing I want to point out is as from the previous presentation on the transmission line, they presented costs that were and constructability options that were essentially flat ground, where costs and complexity would increase because of the topology of getting from that one spot to another. I'm not trying to dismiss them. I'm just saying those are factors that would take into consideration.
I've been looking at that, and it was a great presentation. It really helped kind of solidify some things in my head. But the farther you move up the hill, the more expensive homes that you're going to touch. Some of those homes are million-dollar homes sitting up there. And, it's that, or you put it in a parking lot where there's a lot of shops. That's aesthetically, that's one of the big issues. Cost-wise, there are ways to be able to do that, and we ought to be able to talk about it, because there might be some flat areas, then you're going to go up and then another flat area. So it's stepped up that way. So anyway, my input would be that we don't take things off the table until we sit down again and talk about, does this make good sense? Because there are some options. And it's taken a while. I mean, we're all learning in that process. And like I said, I think when Mr. Gibbs here writes something up and he sent it out, we all started looking at it saying, well, there might be a way of making this work. And taking into consideration the cost factors, I think Wendy has said that, we're looking at partnerships when it comes to cost. We're willing to do things because in the end, it's going to impact a lot of people for many, many years to come. So, anyway, but I appreciate what you're doing.
Robin Vogel again, 63 Balsam Drive. Just a couple of comments. First, I understand you're kind of under a time frame here with your meeting schedule, but this is, and I've lost track, this is probably the 6th, 7th, maybe even the 8th time I've done a one-day turnaround from Kirkland to come over here for this to protect the value of my property in Chelan. So I'm spending 7 hours again today of my time. That's just drive time, not including the meeting time. I have a business to attend to,
and have other business at home. But this is important because this is going to affect my property values, our property values, huge, huge, huge. I mean, we're talking, you know, $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 worth of value if those poles and lines go in front of my view of the lake. And I'm just talking about me, but behind me there are these people and there are many, many more, like I think Carolyn said earlier, that can't make it to these meetings because they have jobs to go to. Fortunately, I have a job where I have this kind of flexibility that I can do this. What I keep hearing is we're bumping up against the pressure of the deadline, the power, the need to not go past the 80% power capacity usage, you know, that we're going to start experiencing brownouts or whatever. One thing that I mentioned at Chelan City Council here a couple weeks ago, Wendy may be able to speak to that, I don't know, temporary permit moratorium. They've done it in Kirkland. They've done it a couple times. The first time I know of in Kirkland was in about the late 80s when there was a huge public outcry about the canyonization of downtown Kirkland because of the giant condos that were being built around the entire downtown. It felt like we were in the Roman Colosseum. But that was not the intent. It blocked the lake view of a lot of people, and it made the downtown corridor ugly. And you know what? It's not going away. It's not going to go away for another 40, 50 years until they start tearing down some of those buildings. I would hate to see the same thing happen here. If the PUD and the city of Chelan could work in conjunction, again, this whole cooperative effort of doing some sort of a moratorium on issuing new building permits until we get this figured out and we get it figured out right. I would hate to think that we had to rush to get a substation in and I end up having my view decimated where 10 years down the road, now we got it figured out, we can do it right. Well, great for my neighbor or whoever on the South Shore that isn't going to have their view decimated. Well, I get to live with mine. That's the main thing. I mean, it just seems like it's time to start doing some things differently. So that's my main point. And I will tell you that I appreciate the fact that you're trying to lower the view impact and trying to come up with something that is going to impact as few people as possible, or businesses for that matter as well. There's a lot of view-dependent businesses in this area, for example, the wineries. You know, I really appreciate that, but if you get it down to 7 or 5, or 3 properties, if my property is one of those properties, I guarantee you I'm going to be furious, and I will not back down. Because as I said at one of the prior meetings, when I pointed to those engineer renderings of the power poles, those are not going on my property, period. And I don't like to get like this. I don't want this to be a confrontational type thing. But what I've heard today, a lot of it sounds like a lot of double talk, and it sounds like we've gone back to where we were prior to the March 20th meeting. And the fact that I know that I'm going to have to keep coming over here to fight this thing because I haven't seen anything in writing that says that those power poles and lines have been taken off the table, I'll keep doing it as long as I have to do it to protect my property value. Because I don't know how long it takes y'all to save over $500,000 after taxes to buy a piece of land with a house on it, but it takes me a while. And that's the bottom line. And I'm not going to allow my view to be decimated. Thank you for your time.
Carolyn Glassinger, 490 Boyd Road. 2 points. One, Steve over here mentioned, as far as underground, you guys haven't done that, but yet I keep hearing that there's underground, like at Manson School, there's underground at the Lookout. How did that get in there? How did that happen? And so the fact is it's already, you've got some spots with underground and it's being maintained. Why is Steve's report saying you've never done it, you don't know how to do it, yet I hear it's been done and it's been maintained. So I don't understand the difference.
Difference between the transmission and the distribution lines. So their distribution does go underground, but the transmission is above ground. Bringing electricity to an area, large line, has not been done underground.
Okay.
And new developments are required to the developers are required to put in conduit so that all the power will be underground for all new developments.
Okay.
I believe, at least in the Chelan Basin.
Okay, that's good. I hope we can just keep that movement going.
Yeah, I just want to reassure everybody that this is the process, and you know, I think Michael said it well that you know, we do have time pressures, and we you've been heard, and we're continuing to work on those issues. And what we're all doing is we're learning and getting better at understanding what are the implications and consequences, and we're going to continue to work on that. So that's what these gentlemen are going to continue to do. We're not making a decision until we vet this process, and we will keep everybody informed. There won't be any surprises, and we're going to keep moving forward. So thank you for being here, and we appreciate your comments, but staff are listening to those and trying to work as much as we can to do a good job for you. Thank you.
So, thank you for your input. It's 12:30. Don't know that we probably can't cover that one now at this point, so we'll have to we'll connect. We need to recess and reconvene. I'm going to push it back to 1:15 to reconvene and for 15 minutes in executive session. So.
So 1:30, if we go back into general
1:30 back in general, regular session. So. Good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon business session, May 1, 2017, of Chelan Public Utility District. We met this morning in study session. We met from 1:15 to 1:30 in executive session, and we're just now coming out of executive session. No votes were taken, no decisions were made, and as most of you in the room were here this morning, you know we got a little bit behind this morning on our agenda, and we were, with the permission of the commission, going to make a few adjustments to the agenda going forward. We are going to drop the legislative update, drop item 9, the strategy partners update, and we're going to add a resolution number 17 to the agenda under the regular agenda, and that would be a resolution authorizing the general manager to purchase a 3.01 acre of land located adjacent to the Chumstick Highway from John and Wendy Fishburne. That would be the resolution for us to consider. And before we do the AMI and the first quarter district performance plans, we would like to move them to after the regular agenda resolutions in place for right where the manager items would be. Does that meet with approval? All right. That being said, we have a consent agenda, commissioners. And that consent agenda has already been modified to include resolutions 14 and 15. What is the wish of the commission?
Move to approve the consent agenda. Second. As modified.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda with the addition of resolutions 14 and 15. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried and the consent agenda is approved. And now we're on to the regular agenda with resolution number 12.
The resolution authorizing the general manager of the district to execute Amendment 4 to the power sales agreement and Amendment 3 to the collateral deposit agreement with Alcoa Corporation and Alcoa Power Generating Incorporated. Kelly Boyd and Michael Padgett will be at the desk here if there are any further questions following up on this morning's presentation.
And Kelly Woodard is also in the audience for any questions.
Okay. Commissioners, we had a pretty thorough review this morning. Are there any additional questions for any of the people here, any member of the audience have any questions or concerns on this resolution? Hearing none, I would I'd like to suggest that we take resolution 12 as a standalone item and for consideration, so I would certainly entertain a motion for adoption.
I move to approve resolution number 12, authorizing the general manager of the district to execute amendment 4 to the power sales agreement and amendment 3 to the collateral deposit agreement with Alcoa Corporation and Alcoa Power Generating, Inc.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 12. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
I would like to make a comment.
You bet.
At this time I was going to, but I didn't quite get it in fast enough. So I have real reservations about this. I guess that's probably clear from what I said this morning. But based on what Kelly Woodard, who represents the union, based on what he said and the fact that he supports it, and feels that it is the best path forward for the employees and for Alcoa in the Valley, then because of that, I did vote yes.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We want an announcement within 6 months that it's going to be open now. All right. Resolution 13.
It's a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 16-169, with Search Technologies Corporation of Herndon, Virginia, for enterprise search development services. Particularly wanted to bring this one forward just because we've had some conversation about the need to for our workforce to be dealing with a lot more data and how we manage data. That's one of our challenges as we move to the 2020s. This is just a small example of that. John Yale?
Afternoon, I'm John Yale. I'm the Hydroplant Engineering Manager. And as all good companies now in our modern times, we have a lot of electronic data out there. And accessing that and finding it can be a challenge even in an extremely well-structured system, let alone on older documents that have been archived. This came to light particularly around the C8 to C11 turbine issues, trying to find various documentation and reports, factory tests, site reports, design reports, that type of thing. So we looked for a search tool that would enable us to access our electronic records that we have on various drives, FileNet, SharePoint, places like that, to make it efficient for my focus being my staff and the operational folks, but all of engineering and all of the district, to find the documentation that we need. So Todd's going to talk a little bit about the solution that they came up for this.
Hi, so my name's Todd Walsh. I haven't met everybody before, but I'm a systems analyst in our Information Technology Department Asset Management Systems Group. The IT Steering Committee approved this project in early 2016 because, as John said, it leverages our investments in our existing IT assets and people. We issued the RFP in October 2016, selected a company called Search Technologies Corporation out of Virginia. And after that, negotiated a three-year, $545,000 system agreement with them over the entire three-year period. The system agreement organizes the work in phases, where we will approve 10 phases, where we will approve the work after each phase before we authorize them to proceed on to the next phase. The contract includes implementation services and licenses their software that will allow us to unify content from all of our systems into a single Google-style search for all our users. And so then before you is a resolution for authorizing this system agreement with Search Technologies.
Any questions? Thank you.
Relatively small contract, but again, part of this transition to how do we deal with the reams of data that we're confronted with. Number 16 is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 1 through 1-01 through 1-04, 2-01, 3-01, 3-02, 4-01, and 4-02, and approving field work order change order number 3-03 to contract number 15-23 with Alstom Power Incorporated for Rocky Reach Unit C8 through C11 stator winding replacement. George Velasquez will be presenting for us today.
I'm George Velasquez. I'm the manager for the Rocky Reach Lake Chelan EPMD team. Steve, can you repeat that for me, please?
Not do those numbers again.
So, as Steve said, here to get ratification on all field work orders, with exception of 3-03. We're seeking approval for execution of 3-03 with Alstom Power Incorporated, and that's under contract 15-23. We have a total of 9 field work orders currently. They've all been executed to date, supporting completion of the winding replacement for units C8 through C11 at Rocky Reach. And I just want to point out that we're approximately going to complete all 4 windings about 2 years ahead of schedule. The district staff evaluated all and negotiated all these field work orders prior to execution, obviously. And the reason we're here is general manager has a signatory authority up to 500,000 cumulative field work orders on any project. And with this field work order 3-03, we will exceed that. So we are seeking board approval prior to execution of that field work order. Field work order 3-03 is payment for early winding completion to unit C9. And like I mentioned, there are 4 units that are being rewound. C9 was the 3rd, and we have 1 more to go, and we're working on that right now. Alstom Power completed the rewind approximately 14 days ahead of schedule. Their completion date was April 1st, and per contract, they were supposed to be completed April 15th. So that gave them 14 days of incentive pay. The incentive pay per day was approximately, or was per contract, $15,000 per day. So that's where the $210,000 came up. One note to make, or another note to make, C11, the 4th unit, also has incentives tied to it. Now, the overall aggregate for the incentive pay on this contract is not to exceed $300,000, so there's still $90,000 left for potential incentive pay on that C11. The total... like I mentioned, the total for the incentive pay is $300,000. And in that contract, we also included liquidated damages. So if they don't complete that 4th unit on time per the contract, liquidated damages could be assessed. Any questions?
George, did I hear you correctly early? You said that we're about 2 years ahead of schedule.
That's correct. So when we kicked off and signed this contract with Alstom Power, we were planning 1 rewind per year. So that's 4 units, and it kicked us out to 2019 for the 4th unit. Now, I think everybody understands a lot of things happen out there. Additional units were out of service due to winding failures. So we renegotiated actually twice to reschedule the sequence of those units, and we ended up approximately 2 years ahead of schedule. We'll be done August 2017 with the 4th rewind. Originally, we were going to be done end of 2019.
So we currently have 3 of those units back online then?
Not necessarily. We have 1 unit back online right now. C10 is running right now. C8 had some issues with it, outer head covers. I'm sure you're aware of that. And C9 is currently being commissioned.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about this in the quarterly performance review.
Okay, I was just thinking about the ahead of schedule and having those units online, the generation capacity that we're no longer losing.
Right. So there's 2 pieces to that. First of all, there are different components that are being repaired. So we're still working on the turbine shaft problem. Then we've got a head cover problem, and then we've got a stator problem. So the stators are getting finished ahead of schedule, which is good. And in this case, we were able to get the whole unit back up 14 days early, which we paid the incentive, about $210,000. The value of the power that we generated is about $100,000 more than that.
Yeah.
So it was worth it to us to pay the incentive because we made money on the deal, basically. So we're still working through how do we get all the units back up and running.
Yeah, that's correct.
So I have a question. Does that 2 years ahead of schedule, does that include any incentive pay because we're ahead of schedule?
For Alstom, maybe.
Well, we're paying
restate your question. For
the $210,000 that mm-hmm. we paid for the days ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're looking at 2 years ahead of schedule. Are there any payments we would have to make because we're ahead of schedule?
No. The only potential additional payment, like I mentioned, we've got a total aggregate of $300,000 incentive pay to Alstom under this contract. If we approve this, it's $210,000. So there's only $90,000 left on the table. So we could be coming back to you, or I could be coming back to you and presenting another field work order for the $90,000 if they hit that contract schedule for the fourth unit, that C9 rewind.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So commissioners, one of the lessons learned out of this particular contract, I thought I'd share with you and how we're planning to address it in case you have different thoughts. But so recall last time we were here and Chad Rissman presented the unit price contract closeout, and we had a field work order change order that represented the true up of the actual dollar values paid to the units that we had worked in the field. Also, we had a conversation when this field work order 303 came forward about the fact that interestingly, the incentive payments were already in the contract that was approved by the board, and the contract value would naturally adjust upward or downward automatically based upon the terms of that contract. One of the things that we have historically done here at the district, though, is awarded in your contract resolution contract values that are literally penny specific. So if you look on the second page, the second paragraph, the original contract award for this project was the $18,306,799.18, but we did not allow for that amount that was awarded to fluctuate upward or downward automatically, even to account for the provisions that were already in the contract. So that, in and of itself, is what made this field work order change order necessary. Had we allowed for that fluctuation to account for what contract terms were already approved by the board, then we wouldn't need the fieldwork order 303. So one of the things that we're working on as a staff is a way to try to expedite that process by revising slightly your award resolution language to account for those automatic increases where there are incentives or other efficiency payments, or deducts where there are inefficiency deducts or liquidated damage provisions. And then it would be incumbent on staff as we award those contracts to make sure the board is aware that those provisions exist in those contracts that are being awarded. So in the future, you might see that language, and it will be a slightly different thing, but it might speed the process a little. Questions about that? It wasn't interesting in all of the time I've worked for the district. An interesting bit of information to learn, and I think something that's easily fixed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then our last resolution is resolution number 17.
This is a resolution authorizing the general manager to purchase a 3.01 acre of land located adjacent to the Chumstick Highway from John and Wendy Fishburne. I think we're going to turn this one to Eric.
Okay, so I guess by default we didn't arrange for a presenter of this one. I apologize for that. And, so I drew the short straw. So, commissioners, part of what we've been undertaking in the substation outreach over the last couple of years, you're well aware of leading that process, has been an evaluation of potential sites in the Leavenworth area. That outreach effort, again, led primarily by the commission here, has resulted in staff and community through their working group to identify some potential sites the district board has already heard about in prior presentations within a general area in Leavenworth, and there are two sites. I think there's a men's site and a city site that you've already heard. So during part of that outreach process, district staff, when they were in the area, was looking for alternate sites as well, in addition to those two, and became aware that a site owned by Mr. and Mrs. Fishburne might be put on the market for sale, and approached Mr. and Mrs. Fishburne about the willingness to sell that
parcel to the district at the time. At the time, it's my understanding, although I was not directly involved in the conversation, that there had been some action and the Fishburns indicated they were going to see what the market would bear for a period of time, and if a time arose when they believed they would be interested in coming to the district, they would reach out to us. Indeed, that apparently has happened. My understanding is the Fishburns may have had an offer on the property or have an offer on the property that is not apparently going to close. They reached out to the district staff recently and inquired as to the district would still be willing to purchase their property. Staff in its evaluation has determined that the property is an excellent potential site for a substation. There's a home on the site. Staff believes there is the possibility of enough land availability here that you could actually carve off the home and resell it, although that's not a certainty until the rest of the site analysis is complete. I'm going to lean into Chad Rissman since he is still here and wore a jacket today, embarrassingly to me. In case you have any questions about the substation site specific. In any event, we were able to negotiate with the Fishburns purchase and sale agreement that would result in a closing of the sale for purchase. The PUD would take a fee title to the property. It would become available then as part of the ongoing outreach effort that the board is leading with the working group in the area for evaluation of a potential substation. It is not, and you will see in the draft resolution, it is not intended to be a decision on that topic. It is intended merely to preserve an option for the district to be able to build in the general area that's been identified by the working group if the other sites do not come to fruition. So the decision as to where and on which property a substation might ultimately be developed is still left to the board and whatever process the board deems appropriate, seeking guidance from the staff and the working groups. But it does preserve that optionality for the district given the need. So the staff saw it as an opportunity, and we have willing sellers, and we are able to negotiate a purchase and sale agreement, and it is being presented to the board for consideration of the resolution. The resolution purports to authorize Steve as general manager to complete the sale and purchase of that property. Happy to answer questions if you have any.
Questions? Any questions from any member of the public? Okay. That being the case, we've had three resolutions, 13, 16, and 17 presented to us. What is the wish of the commission on those three resolutions?
I would move to authorize Steve to complete the purchase of the John and Wendy Fishburn property for the purchase of a...
You want to take that one separate from the other two or do all three together?
Oh, I thought you wanted to do that separately.
It doesn't matter. I mean, if the commission wants to do it separately, we can certainly do that. So that's fine.
I'll just move to approve the remaining three agenda items. Okay.
Second. So moved and seconded to approve the three remaining resolutions 13, 16, and 17. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Okay, now I'd like to circle back to our morning agenda and item 7, which is the AMI update.
I think we're going to mostly skip the plan for the AMI update in order to keep us moving along, with one exception. So we did have a request from a customer owner that had a statement they wanted to make and asked us to read it into the record.
Okay.
And so I have that here, and I am prepared to do that.
Okay.
This is from Robin Castle. She says, I believe and hope that the PUD, a publicly owned energy company, first responsibility is the health and safety of its people and environment. Research from sources that aren't compromised with bias or in alliance to energy companies or government agencies have proven that biology is adversely affected when exposed to RF radiation microwave frequency. Dr. Samuel Milham was one of the first scientists who alerted the world, linking electromagnetic pollution to human disease. He is the author of the books Dirty Electricity and Electrified, the Disease of Our Civilizations. Even the American Cancer Society states that RF radiation, microwave frequency, and smart meters has enough to move atoms and molecules or cause them to vibrate. The Agency for Research on Cancer, ARC, classifies RF radiation as a possible carcinogenic to humans and goes on to say it is possible that smart meters could increase cancer risk. In America, we see a lot of misinformation about the safety of RF radiation coming from corporations that benefit financially from smart meters, just as we saw the tobacco industry hide its research on the harmful effects of tobacco. Almost everywhere smart meters have been deployed, a percentage of the population begins to experience symptoms such as tinnitus, headaches, sleepless, fatigue, heart palpitations, nosebleeds, and pacemaker malfunction. These people are the canaries in the coal mines. In Sweden, where electrosensitivity is officially recognized, doctors there claim this is what happens when people are constantly exposed to RF radiation that smart meters emit. Companies like Pacific Gas and Electric state that smart meters emission are below the supposed safe levels. However, they fail to tell you the Federal Communication Commission guidelines are obsolete and do not cover long-term, low-level exposure from RF radiation. Doctors interviewed in the documentary Take Back Your Power took blood tests and linked smart meter exposure to chronic inflammation, which could lead to serious diseases. Health issues aren't the only dispersing byproducts of smart meters. There has been many smart meters that exploded or caught on fire. Some insurance companies won't cover the damage. Is the PUB going to take on these liabilities? Is the PUB going to guarantee that these devices won't be used to collect personal data that could be shared with anyone, including governmental agencies? In today's environment with water and air pollution, contaminated food, stress from much EMF cell phone computers, is it really in our best interest for the public to place another stress on our biology and environment? This technology isn't smart, it's dumb. If the commissioners decide to implement these dumb meters, are they going to be financially and emotionally accountable for any damage or harm created by their decision? I hope you fully move into your heart before making such an important decision. Robin Castle. So we are gathering comments from customer owners across the district and putting them in categories and developing our thoughts about those. And that was initially what we were going to do, is provide some information about that today, but it can wait till the next meeting. And given the time constraints, we're prepared to do that and come back to you 2 weeks from now to discuss.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, item 8, first quarter district performance plan.
Okay, so we're going to do this in the usual way. We're going to report by exception anything that is yellow or red against our performance plan. And so you should have the performance plan.
I think it's coming.
Okay. You will soon have the performance plan in front of you. And I'm going to invite Dave Nelson to come up and just pause for a second, Dave, and let us catch up and get everybody the performance plan.
Thank you. We got to go a few pages. There we are.
Right, on page 4,
yep.
Dave will be talking about Rocky Reach Large Unit Permanent.
Yeah, I'm Dave Nelson. I'm subbing in for Kirk today. And the first item is the completing the C8 by June 1st. Our schedule is now delayed. Forecast return on October 1st due to the head cover delays on C8.
And we'll be talking about more about these. We have some issues with the contractor about these that we'll be discussing further.
The next two items are related. The initiating this disassembly of the second large unit by 1231, that one we have marked as yellow. We're currently forecasting to start that right about that time, 1231, and it's delayed due to the C8 head cover delays. The next item down is completing the bridge crane refurbishment by December 1st, and right now we are anticipating a completion by December 15th, again due to the C8 head cover delays, which then delays the timing of when we can do that bridge crane work. And the next item down, we have marked as red, which is completing B6 at Rock Island, Powerhouse 1, by July 31st. And we are currently forecasting that will be October 31st, delayed due to voter repairs not being successful. And so we are putting a new rotor in, and then the head cover delays on B6 also.
We're going to move over to legislative issues and page 5. Jeff Smith.
Commissioners, Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. On page 5, legislative strategies, we have in yellow for early action credit and FERC rulemaking and state carbon reduction. All three of those are still in play. We did have some successes earlier. On page 6, the hydro licensing reform, that's red. No new action in Congress on that. And also on page 6 for project management and engineering support, that's red. Your Dave's report a moment ago about generating units C8 at Reach and B6 at Rock Island.
I'll say quickly about these federal legislative activities. We get differing reports almost every week as to whether they're going to move a comprehensive energy bill or not. So we're discouraged this week, and hopefully we'll be encouraged next week. Let's see. Thank you, John. Up next.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Sowell, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I have the next two on substations. One is about acquiring both Chelan and Leavenworth substation properties by end of Q1. We're certainly on a path with Leavenworth, but not quite there yet with Chelan. So that is red. And subsequently, on the meet the goal of land acquisition and the conditional use permit completed by the end of Q3, that's probable or possible with Leavenworth. Chelan, we most likely won't hit that either, so that's why it's marked red.
And you'll note from our presentation this morning, it is our goal to try to get the preferred alternative identified in Q2 for the end of July. Next up is Brian. Wait, I'm sorry, but Dave, you're not up quite yet, Brian. You were surprising me there.
The next one is
John's coming back.
Page 7, executing 80% of our capital plans. And for generation transmission right now, for the first quarter, we're only at 25%. Just expenses are currently lagging behind schedule, just the timing of when things happen and when these projects get going. We are still forecasting right now that we will, we will spend 107% of our budget, mostly driven by Rock Island. Our current forecast on all the projects at Rock Island, the modernizations, if those all go on track the way we have them forecasted and planned right now, we would actually be coming back to the board to adjust the Rock Island system budget to accommodate that. But right now, we're only at 25% for the first quarter.
John Stoll again. I have the next one. Utility services, we have a higher goal. It's 90%. Actually, year to date, we're at 85%. We are just starting what we consider our traditional construction season. So really, the 85% it's a pretty strong year. We've actually had the opportunity to knock some work out. But similar to what David said, we expect to meet our target, if not exceed it. And we may be back later in the year. Again, favorable construction works out.
Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. I have an actual of 12% year-to-date that's related to the telecom projects and the major PPB construction. The PPB construction was started a little bit late due to the winter lingering on. Both projects are on schedule. However, the recognition of the cost is lagging a little bit behind. We do expect to finish the year around 85 to 90% of the budget.
What's the number you expect, number of houses this year?
This year, 928.
Okay. To be exact.
Commissioners, Jeff Smith again. Capital spending is red. We are under budget by 6% due to delay in processing the RFP for security camera upgrades and fleet vehicles that have not yet been received, and we will catch up later in the year.
And I'm subbing in here for Greg Farrington. Also, Energy Resources actually did not have a capital budget for 2017, but there was one carryover project for the electric vehicle charging station to be completed that didn't get done in 2016 that we will be doing. It's about $15,000 left remaining in that project.
Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Officer for IT. The major projects in the budget are the customer information system and the governance, risk, and compliance system. And we got a little ahead of ourselves in the budget and had budget before the planned activities were really in the capital expenditure phase. So we also expect to catch up there later in the year.
Next one is mine, Columbia River Treaty. So we had a goal of starting negotiations by the end of Q1, which we've been told repeatedly by the State Department would occur and has not occurred. And so we continue to express our extreme frustration with the pace of the State Department moving forward. And I know that there have been some outreach from the congressional delegation into the State Department just in the last couple of weeks about the slow pace there.
And is that just because of the transition of government, or do you have any?
I wish I could attribute to that, and I'd have to say no, it's not that. The pace of the State Department problem was a problem before the transition to the new administration. The current view of the State Department is it's subject to the Canadians being willing to come to the table, and because there's an election at the British Columbia provincial level, that they're waiting for that election. We have argued for some time that this could have started quite a long time ago, and that there's an incentive on the part of the Canadians to not initiate negotiations, and that should be recognized and addressed.
The greater the delay, the clock is ticking, so we're still at a time 10-year. You know, now if we issued a notice of termination, it would be 2017 rather than 14.
That's right.
Or 27 rather than 24.
That's right. So the 10-year notice would stretch out to 2027. Some argue that we will be able to get that 3 years back. We have reservations about our ability to get that back. And similarly, the issuing of the termination notice, since the negotiations haven't begun, we've argued strongly that there should be at least a deadline for issuing the termination notice, that if the Canadians don't come to the table, and the State Department has not been willing to do that so far. We do have efforts to reach into the new administration with the trade issues that are going on there to see if we can find a sympathetic ear someplace other than in the State Department.
Okay, I believe I've got the next one. Mike Coleman again on page 13. Fiber cost per active connection. Our Q1 average was $429 compared to a metric of $420. This was due to a Nokia Alcatel support contract that was budgeted over 12 months but was actually paid in March, causing a spike. We do expect it to go back green and remain green.
John Stoll again, page 15. I have an update on the customer information system upgrade. We've met all the deadlines for the Q1. However, you'll see that the selection recommendation is yellow. Out of the RFP process, the request for proposal, we did have a short list and there was a recommendation made. However, we're still reviewing the package, ensuring that it's the best one for the utility given the strategic complexity of this project. We want to make sure we get it right. So we're not there yet as far as identifying we have our solution.
This is a pretty important decision, so we're making sure that we get this one right. Now you're up, Brian.
Brian Hotel for Lorna Klimansky, page 21. So our first one that we have is our incident rate, and these are all rolling 12-month averages. So we ticked up just a little bit in the first quarter to 0.03% above. And so we feel like we're going to be on track. We're just going to move throughout the year as we do that. Our next two actually measure the severity. Each one measures a little bit different, but the severity of those lost time accidents. And those also do include hearing conservation issues that we would have. We've just currently completed a pretty comprehensive study with Confluence Health over 10 years of data, which has outlined the major categories that we have of injuries that are the most severe, most prevalent, and the most lost time. So we're going to be looking at implementing fixes on those or ways to address those. Our final one, which is the senior team safety side visits, we're in yellow mainly because we're switching reporting methods, so we're going to a more automated method of doing that, so we know we have those done, but we haven't got the implementation done on that yet. So. Thanks.
And I think that's it. So first quarter, still early in the year on all of these. Most of the ones that are red and yellow, you can see we expect to catch up.
Question on, everybody was in yellow or red on capital projects. Do we budget on an expected cycle or on a monthly cycle?
So we budget on a monthly cycle based on what we expect to carry out. And historically, our expectations have been that we can accomplish more earlier in the year than we usually do. So while we do try to shape to the best of our predictions about when work will occur, sometimes the weather is bad and delays the ability to start some of the construction projects, as an example. So we do our best to shape to when the work will be carried out, but it's still an area that we have room for improvement.
And there was one other I had with Mike on a cost that you incurred that covers the entire year, but you paid for it in this quarter, so you charged it in this quarter, and that threw you off. There's no way to amortize that cost over the year?
Well,
or is it just too much work?
I think it strictly goes back to the way we budget, and that one was spread out in 12 annual increments rather than a lump sum. But we always pay it in lump sum. So it's just a matter of paying a little bit closer attention to how it goes into the budget each year.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Anybody else have questions? All right. You don't have any manager items, but did you want to do a little bit on strategy partners? Did we drop that?
Well, I would like to just call the attention of the board. There's a package that we'll be using at the strategy partners meeting tomorrow, and I'm pretty confident you're going to recognize all the things that are here, but I would call to your attention just the last few pages, 29 through 33. It's just taking information that you've seen before, and it's just put in a different way. So it's, I think everything else you would have recognized and seen in a previous meeting. This, I think, mostly came out of our presentation to you on the senior management team strategic planning retreat and how we're thinking about developing five-year business plans going forward. So you might want to just take a look at that, and you can get back to me if you have any thoughts about it. Okay. So 29 through 33.
Okay. Super. Thank you. No other manager items?
No other manager items, no.
Commission items? Anybody? I guess I've got one. Last week I went to my, I was filling in for Dennis at Energy Northwest. It was my first Energy Northwest board meeting, and that was an interesting experience. I know Ann has done it for many years, and but you never really gain an appreciation for the entity until you sit there for a while, for a full day. One of the certain aha moments, I think, for the participants of Energy Northwest was the discussion about Bonneville power costs and contracts and the future going forward post-2028 when a lot of contracts change, and their relationship with Energy Northwest, the 92 participants. And I think the aha moment was the 92 participants came to the realization that no matter what happens with their power supply in 2028 going forward, they're all still obligated for the cost of Energy Northwest if they're looking for other energy contracts. It was a huge aha moment for a whole lot of people. So Steve's fully aware of it, being the former Bonneville administrator, of how that works. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. Energy market going forward is probably the most unsettled it's been in a long time, and the most uncertainty. And I know Steve has made that comment to me on a, you know, and probably all of you on one-on-one basis. So anyway, that was an interesting moment for me. You're here. All right. Let's talk about commission travel.
I'm Lisa Sanders, admin and finance, with the commissioner travel update. And we don't have very many changes since last time. Commissioner Smith just returned from Energy Northwest, and we have Commissioner Congdon traveling for NWPPA in May. Then we have in June APPA. I have Commissioner Arsenault and Smith registered. Are you still planning to attend, Commissioner McKenna?
Yes.
Okay. I'll need to get your registration. Mm-hmm. Then in June, Commissioner Congdon, Water Committee, do you have hotel dates? Or do you know yet?
It would just be the night before the 28th.
Okay. And I have only Commissioner Smith traveling to D.C. for APPA in July. Mm-hmm. Then Waputa and Ocean Shores.
Do we have the information where that will be?
I don't have hotel information. Do any of you, have any of you heard?
No.
So I don't have rooms held for that. Then Energy Northwest in July. Commissioner Smith or Bowles. Waputa September and October. And Energy Northwest in October, we do have rooms held for that.
I won't be attending that.
Okay.
The Energy Northwest Forum.
And for Commissioner McKenna's information, that October 26th meeting with Energy Northwest is a really good venue to gain a flavor of what Energy Northwest is and does. And then it's an open forum for all commissioners.
Now, is that in Pasco? Or
yeah, Tri-Cities,
or?
Yeah.
He's in Kennewick.
Okay, we have rooms held for Waputa in November, and Waputa in December is in Spokane. I'm not sure where that is, what hotel yet.
Davenport Hotel.
Thank you.
Davenport Grand.
Davenport what?
Grand.
That's Grand.
I think it's the old one.
No, that's the new one.
The brand new one.
That's the new one. It's right across from the Doubletree.
Right. Is there anything else?
Are any commissioners planning to, to go to the May 18th Waputa Strategic Planning Meeting in Olympia?
I don't. They generally ask what officers of all the committees, and I can't remember. I don't think it's a y'all come. I'm not sure. Okay. So, yeah. But I will check on that.
Lisa, I'm a question mark on November Waputa. Probably not attending November 15 through 17.
Okay. Do you want me to cancel the room or?
Yeah, go ahead and cancel it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, can I make any other changes for you?
Thanks for your work on this, though.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I'll just follow up with you, Commissioner McKenna, for your registration then.
Just tell me. I'll get going.
It's time.
It is
time. It's time.
Thank you.
Lisa, can I, you and I meet offline about alternate travel plans for the trip to Orlando?
Thank you. Let me know when
you're
ready.
Thank you.
Okay. Follow up on delegation.
It was a pretty light week last week, or 2 weeks ago. We worked with you on the Alcoa working group, and two commissioners showed up, so that worked out fine. Didn't need to do a special meeting. And you asked for the satellite systems management agreement between the district and Chelan County, and Eric actually sent that, I think, on the same day. So that one's done.
Super.
That's it.
And from this week?
Yeah, we've got a couple of them. So we've moved AMI to the next meeting. Just this one's really more for you. If you have any feedback for me on the strategy partners document that you have there, give it to me tonight. I'd appreciate it. And I think we're going to need to work through where we're going next with the Chelan substation. Our goal will be to try to bring back some additional information on May 15th, and we're trying to narrow the scope of areas that we're looking at. And in order to be successful, we'll need your input on that. So we'll be bringing you some information about Chelan substation on May 15th.
Okay. Speaking of the Chelan substation, there's that meeting, just for fellow commissioners' awareness, I think we won't be noticing that as a public meeting the 30th, 31st, or 1st of June. So if two commissioners want to go, that's fine. But I think that for the committee to effectively get their work, that I think that would be the preferred approach for that meeting. No more than two commissioners. Yeah. So unless we get overridden by the commission. Mm-hmm. All right. No other delegation?
That's it.
Any other additional public comment? Any other matters to come before the commission before we go into executive session for approximately
60 minutes?
60 minutes to discuss with legal counsel, agency enforcement action.
Yeah, we don't need the properties piece anymore.
Right. Don't need the property. Just the legal action.
Correct.
Knowing it's going to be 60 minutes, so let's take a break till 2:30 and come back at 2:30. So we're back in regular session before we go into executive session, because the purpose of the executive session has to have an added item, and that is for the consideration of a purchase of real estate lease.
Correct. Thank you.
Now we'll go into executive session. It is 3:15 on May 1st, 2017. We're coming out of executive session. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.